All fundamentalist religions are under attack. The Christian religion is under attack. The Islamic faith is under attack. Orthodox Judaism is under full-blown attack. Liberty is under attack. Patriotism is under attack. The Constitution is under attack. Anyone who believes in the Constitution is under attack.
This is Bristol. It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show. Streaming not live, just pre-recorded this afternoon from PRSC Arts Centre in Bristol, the old Temple of Port in the Empire of Lies. We're live on the talkradio.org.uk stream at radioqUK.com in Camberley, Surrey, DJ Plug Radio in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, and radiosoapbox.com in Worthing, as well as, that's East Sussex, by the way, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available free from all good app stores. Aurora, please, not Google Play. I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its military propaganda psyops, boring us to tears with irrelevant distractions and puff pieces on the conspirators, hatchet jobs on the heroes. And we'll be hearing about one of those tonight, Crispin Blunt, who first warned that British parliamentarians could be guilty of war crimes by either materially or verbally supporting Netanyahu. Crispin Blunt, yeah, McCarthyite witch hunts going on after anyone with influence who speaks up for humanity. Oh, and by the way, Crispin is now no longer standing as a Tory MP, despite all this. Speaks up for humanity or against World War III and wage slavery. For those with eyes to see and ears to hear, the so-called solutions to every crisis, Gaza, Ukraine, COVID, migrants, farming, the cost of living and climate, twisted Armageddonist accelerationist policies crafted to make every crisis worse, and the politicians have nothing to say. Almost all of the politicians, anyway, apart from the fringe parties. Nick Land's behaviourist Dark Enlightenment drones, the cowards and control freaks, want us slaves to their machines. Albert Pike's World War III slugfest relies on the media's blind obedience. Meanwhile, wife-murdering pantheist WEF King Tampon Charlie and the witch queen Camilla wage war on the British people, as well as China, Russia and the BRICS, with Libyan regime change maniac psychic Diddy David Cameron. So, no Martin Summers this week, just me, I'm afraid, but we've got some good guests, that is to say, Dia Moodley from Bristol here, hearing that the police just handed on over his property to the Bristol University to destroy. And also Heiko Ku, who's standing here in London. So, I think before we start, let's have a look at a couple of interesting stories I've seen which are not audio pieces. One of them is on Labour's secret plans for taxation of inheritance. This is an interesting tweet that I saw earlier this week. It says, Labour busted the sneaky secret plans. They're denying six party MPs, including Keir Starmer, have a plan to raise £60 billion. Of course, this is what we're not being told by the mainstream press or by the Labour Party, which is a sort of secret Mandelsonian manifesto. So they want to increase inheritance tax, which is okay for people who've got absolutely loads and loads and loads of money, but not for people in the middle. And of course, they're saying things like that people with houses worth £1 million are going to have to pay tax. Well, there are maybe millions of houses now, particularly in London, and actually many here in Bristol, which are over £1 million. So all that tax that people paid during the purchasing of it, when they die, they can't hand it on to their kids. They'll have to sell it to pay the tax, even if it's just a house, one house. Increasing capital gains tax, a jackpot levy on wealth. For those with so much money that they wouldn't know, if half of it was taken away, they wouldn't notice any difference. The really super greedy. Of course, this is great, but why aren't we being told about capital gains and inheritance tax reforms? And they're also saying that council tax reforms, the Labour Party are planning, could also double bills. Well, we'll see if that's true. I'll put a link up to that tweet on our show page at this week www.electionmania.org.uk. This week we've got a whole load of stuff from Election Mania from the fringe candidates. We've also got a specific look at property development, that is to say gentrification and the forces behind it. Fascinating stuff, I thought. I'd not heard much about that before. And then in part two, a whole section on Ukraine, hearing from Jeffrey Sachs, also Stoltenberg, as he says goodbye. But most importantly, we'll be starting part two with Aleksandar Vučić, the Serbian president. He says war is coming, folks. The train has now left the station. There's very little anyone can do about it. Then on to Israel in part two. Again, Norman Finkelstein has come out with a very interesting analysis, saying that we've reached the tipping point, in fact, possibly past the tipping point for Israel. It may be now that they're past the point of no return. Also, as I mentioned just now, Tory MP Crispin Blunt warning Sunak against support for Israel and then being basically accused of rape and drug dealing and booted out of the Conservative Party, so he can't stand again anyway. Isn't that interesting? And finally, a bit of stuff on Stonehenge since it's the solstice last week. That is Jack Hargreaves from Out of Town, the old guy that used to do, when we were kids, the How programme has got some interesting insight into priesthood's power and the calendar and human sacrifice at Stonehenge. And then finally, Tim Dews, Airborne Pyrotechnics, down near Warminster, who I had a chat with last year. So, Iranian and Russian news banned in the UK, first by the telecoms cartel and then by Ofcom. Us cancelled off Bristol Community FM by the Bristol Mafia, but not cancelled here quite yet. So we start this week with Farage and Reform UK. He had in some interesting things to say this week up in Blackpool about the whole idea of property and property prices being forced up by this mass migration of £750,000 a year, people a year coming in, is the thing that is keeping property, is basically causing the housing crisis. He talks about that towards the end here. But you can tell, whether or not you support Farage, these are real politicians, people that speak from the heart, a bit like rock stars that should but and haven't sold out. So this is about 20 minutes, but let's have a listen to the speech by Nigel Farage from Blackpool this week.
Good evening, Blackpool! Yeah. Guess who's back? Back again. Because I'd been retired for 4 years. I thought it was all done. I spent 27 years of my life campaigning for us to leave the European Union. Everybody said, you're wasting your time. It will never happen. And that was why, after the Brexit vote, I was able to get up in the European Parliament and to say, when I came here all those years ago, I said I would lead a campaign to get Britain to leave the European Union, and you all laughed at me. Well, I said, you're not laughing now, are you? But there we were in Parliament Square. It was the 31st of January, 2020. And it was my honour to do the countdown. 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Whee! And so that was it. I was done. It was all over. And then they made such a mess of it. They tried to overturn the vote. Do you remember? Yes. We've got some very sharp people in this audience, haven't we? Yes, Keir Starmer and others said we got it wrong. We, the morons, the plebs, we got it wrong. And we had to vote again. And Starmer was absolutely leading that charge. You're right to say so. So I came back out of retirement to set up the Brexit Party. And we smashed it in those European elections. Within 6 weeks, we got double the number of votes of the nearest party. And we got the resignation of possibly the worst Prime Minister in British history, though there's been some competition since. It's not wrong, is it? So we got the resignation of Theresa May. That was great news. And in came Bouncy Boris. Bouncy Boris. Amazing, really, isn't it, to think that we could have had a Prime Minister who refused to say in public how many children he had, because he simply didn't know. I mean, you know, not that I'm a Methodist preacher or anything like that, but that did seem pretty extraordinary. And then in 2019, even later in the year, in the December election, realising that Corbyn, who hated this country, the Liberal Democrats, who would sign us up to everything, could have won the election, I made the most difficult political decision of my life, and I stood aside in 320 seats, giving the Conservatives a free run, and they won an 80-seat majority, and we helped them. We significantly helped them. Since that date, they have literally betrayed the trust of 17.4 million people who voted for Brexit, the trust of those who put their faith in the Conservatives in 2019, the trust and to some extent the reputation of me, who gave them the benefit of the doubt. And you all know in Blackpool, one of the biggest reasons we voted Brexit, yes, of course it was about getting back control of our country. Of course it was about us, through a democratic system that our forebears fought for. And didn't the recent shenanigans in D-Day just sum up where the heart of this Prime Minister really is? We voted to get back control of our country. We voted to honour those that went before us and made the sacrifice so that we could be free. We voted so that our children and grandchildren could live in that freedom and liberty. But we voted to get back control of our borders. We voted to reduce mass immigration on a scale that these islands had never seen. And what have the Tories done? What have they done? They have no, they haven't done nothing. You're wrong about that. Go to the bottom of the class. They've made it worse. Go to the top of the class. Made it worse. Think about this, folks. Net migration into our country from Windrush, right up until Tony Blair got elected, ran at 40, 50,000 a year. And it ran for that for 50 years. And you could say, by the end of the last century, that we had the best levels of integration and assimilation of those who'd come from different countries and different cultures of any country in Europe. And I think it was something, actually, we were really rather proud of. Because we've always had, as a nation, big relationships around the rest of the world. In fact, we're the only people in the history of mankind who had an empire that turned into a Commonwealth club of friends. We even play sport with each other. We even like the Australians on good days, you know. Well, only when we're winning, obviously. And so we've always been very accepting. We've always been much more global than any other European country. Then Mr. Blair gets into power, opens the doors up in a way we've never seen before. And we're given the narrative through the mainstream media, the political parties, and our kids are told at school, all immigration is good. Control's not needed. And these bad dudes like Nigel Farage that question the numbers are really beyond the pale. But it was okay because in 2010, the Conservatives got elected. Call Me Dave became our Prime Minister. With his sidekick, that weirdo Osborne, you know. And they promised us in the manifesto they would reduce net migration to tens of thousands a year. They promised it again in the 2015 manifesto. They'd reduce net migration to tens of thousands a year. They promised us again in the 2017 manifesto. They would reduce net migration to tens of thousands a year. And in 2019, with support from me, they told the country they would massively reduce the numbers coming into our country. Blair and Brown net let in 2.7 million people. The Conservatives, since 2010, have now let in 4.3 million people. That's net. And in the last 2 years, net, It's about 1.5 million people. How big a breach of trust is that with the promise of tens of thousands? How big a breach of trust is that with those of us that voted to get back control of our borders? And that was why, with this snap election being called, and with very little time, I thought to begin with, it was impossible. How on earth could I come back, pick up the mantle of leading a political party, fight a constituency seat, travel all around the country and speak at events like this? I didn't think I had time to do it. But I changed my mind, because I realised going around and meeting people that I was being looked in the eye by the people's army of millions who'd supported me through the UKIP years, who'd supported me through the referendum, who'd supported me through the Brexit Party. And they thought I was letting them down. Even though I've given most of my adult life to fighting these causes, they thought I was letting them down. And I came to the view that I can't let them down. And I decided, that's it. I'm coming out of retirement. I'm going to go back. I'm going to lead the party. And the lyrics, guess who's back again, mega. Now, I've got to be honest with you, it's not my invention. It comes from Eminem. And they're now back in the charts on Spotify at number 40. So, please, stream on Spotify Without You from Eminem and give them some support, because though I'm normally an original thinker, we did nick it and they deserve a bit of support. So please do that. Now, you've seen, in the last couple of days, you'd have seen a slew of opinion polls reflected on today's front pages. But these polls are not accurate. These polls are not correct, and here's why. The field work for these polls was done, some of it, one of the polls, the Maureen Common poll yesterday, the field work began on the 22nd of May. The Telegraph front page today, Savanta poll, the field work began on the 4th of June. Well, unless I've got something wrong, we're on the eve of the equinox. It is now the 20th of June. And I would suggest to you that maybe, possibly, since I came back, we might be doing a little bit better than we were before. So, please ignore all of that. They say we'll get no seats. That's what those polls out yesterday suggested. Tonight, there are two polls that have been issued, both of which had the field work done in the last 24 hours. Some up-to-date opinion polls. One shows us neck and neck with the Conservative Party on 19%. The other shows us ahead of the Conservative Party in one of those polls. And we might be trailing, and we are trailing, the Conservatives in London and Scotland, but in the whole of the north of England, in the Midlands, in much of Eastern Region, in parts of the South East, in most of England geographically, we are now the challengers to the Labour Party. And a vote, you hear all this guff from Rishi. Slippery Sunak, that's what I call him. Biggest spinner since Blair, he really is. I mean, I couldn't lie with a straight face like that. I mean, I really couldn't. You know, he said, oh, a vote for reform is a vote for Labour. No. In both of these seats in Blackpool, with Dan and Mark, who you saw earlier, and aren't they just great guys? Great guys. If you vote Conservative in Blackpool South, if you vote Conservative in Blackpool North, a Labour MP will win. But if you vote Reform in Blackpool North, if you vote Reform in Blackpool South, and don't waste your vote with the Conservatives, then I truly believe we can run close and even beat Labour in this town. I do. This campaign has real momentum. Now, I talked about opinion polls, about some of the pollsters saying we won't win any seats. So that's going to move me on to the subject of betting. It would appear that the modern-day Conservative Party is even more corrupt than we thought that it was. We have a former... Did you put money on as well? It's almost unbelievable that one of the National Campaign Director's wives bet on an early election. That a close bodyguard to Rishi Sunak bet on an early election. That a Member of Parliament, who was a private secretary, bet on a July the 4th election. And I've seen the statistics from Betfair, and the volume of traffic the day before the announcement went through the roof. We only know about three or four people. It's clear that on a mass scale, people knew when the election would be in the Conservative Party and used that information to corruptly try and make themselves some money. It tells us everything we need to know, everything we need to know about this rotten political class. It's as if they're literally stealing the light bulbs on the way out of the building. It is a scandal, it is a disgrace, and we'll learn much more about it over the course of the coming days. And it shows why they are completely unfit for office in every single way. They have betrayed our trust, they have betrayed the country, they are corrupt, they've had more MPs suspended. I mean, they talk about our candidates saying a few dodgy things. I mean, how many perverts have they had to kick out over the course of the last 5 years? Not wrong, is it? You know, I mean. But a confession, among my many vices, gambling is one. I love a bet, provided it's free and fair and not based on bent information. So I'll say this right now on the live stream. And by the way, you know, we advertised this with less than 48 hours notice. We said there were 600 seats. They were gone for the following morning. We could have had thousands here tonight, literally thousands here tonight. So well done to all of you guys for getting in early. Watching us on the live stream will be huge numbers of people right now. But I want to point this comment to those that run the polling polling organisations in our country who say we'll get no seats. I'll bet you... I'll bet you whatever you want, old son, that we're going to win seats in this election. And if you want to come back to me, I'm very, very happy to take your money. Not only are we going to win seats, but when people wake up to the fact, and they're waking up now, that this election is effectively over, the Conservatives are gone. They're doomed. They're on the way down. They're going to fall even further. They will lose the vast majority of their seats. And they will deserve to do so. And that Labour is massively ahead. And that unless we have a miracle with reform, Labour are going to win this election. But you see, here's the situation. No one can pretend the polls are close. No one can pretend the polls are tight. So we now give an opportunity to people to vote with their heart, to vote for what they really believe in. There are at least half of those who still say they vote Conservative that agree with us. They agree with a freeze on the overall numbers of immigration coming into our country. They agree with us that the boat should be stopped. They agree with us that raising the level at which people start to pay tax to £20,000 a year will help not just those on low pay, It's a good idea. And boy, wouldn't that policy help Blackpool? With very low incomes for so many people. Very low incomes for too many people. But crucially, those on benefits are not all idlers that smoke dope all day. Some are. And we must deal with them. But many on benefits are genuine people who are trapped. They're trapped because if they go back to work more than 16 hours a week, they lose their benefits and they're worse off in work than they would be on benefits. That's wrong. It's wrong at every level. So our policy would incentivize people on benefits to get back to work. And that wouldn't just make them better off financially, it would make them better off psychologically as well. I'm very, very proud of that policy. And for those who are saying they'll vote Labour, many of them were Brexit voters. Are you really going to vote for secure... Oh, I nearly nodded off there, I'm sorry. I mean, God, isn't he boring? Crikey, O'Reilly. Stop giggling, it's a very serious political meeting, this. Are they really going to vote for a man who wanted to overturn the referendum result? Are they really going to vote for a man who, and this is crucial, when Labour launched their manifesto last week, there were six key objectives. Not one of them mentioned legal immigration. Not one of them mentioned the population explosion in this country. Not one of them mentioned the population crisis in this country. Not one of them mentioned the fact that no wonder there's a shortage of houses because we need to build one new home every 2 minutes in our country just to cope with the levels of immigration into Britain. None of it mentioned. Stop the boats. He almost doesn't even want to talk about it. You can now vote Reform UK. And you can do so knowing that this is not a tight contest. You can do so if you make a decision as to who you think will provide the best opposition to Keir Starmer at the dispatch box in number 10 and out campaigning around the country. And I think people are beginning to get the message, because other polling now, out today, when people are asked, who do you think would provide the best opposition to a Labour government, now has me a country mile ahead of all the other party leaders.
Thank you. That was Nigel Farage, Reform UK, speaking up in Blackpool about particularly this concept that the whole housing crisis really is just caused by migration. But it's not a crisis in a way. Of course, if you're an investor in housing, this is good. This is great. It means that your investment is going up and up and up. And the last thing in the world they want, I remember hearing this years ago, is for house prices to start to fall, because then the whole economy collapses. Actually, the economy's collapsed anyway, because we've lost all the international trade wars with the Chinese, the Russians, etc., which is why we've been throwing our little toys out of the pram in places like Ukraine, because these countries have got such low overheads. So the things like rent, electricity, transport in these countries are very cheap. they're basically provided at cost, like they used to be here in the 1950s, 60s and 70s before privatisation. And so that's one of the main reasons, I think, why the price of housing, it's not a crisis for the rich, it's not a crisis for the big housing investors, it's great for them. So we go on now to have a listen to the other interesting party in this general election, which is the Workers' Party. George Galloway this week made a bit of a stir as he predicted war within 6 months if Keir Starmer is elected to be British Prime Minister.
We say that Britain's participation in the genocide in Gaza, supported by both Conservative and Labour parties, is a national disgrace. Shame from which our reputation will possibly never recover. That our leaders and our alternative leader are up to their neck in Palestinian blood, in the blood of children and women. We have armed it. We have diplomatically covered for it in the United Nations and in other international fora. Our media has endlessly propagandized for it, lied for it. Our Royal Air Force pilots have been forced to fly out of Cyprus on intelligence gathering missions for Netanyahu's murder gang. Who can tolerate such a state of affairs when millions, people say this is a Muslim thing, as if Muslim voters were less than other voters. But get used to this, there's 3.5 million Muslim voters. And scarcely any of them are going to vote Labour at the general election. But most of the people, on the marches, protests, all the different manifestations of distress, grief even, about Gaza in Britain, are not Muslims. They are white English people, Scottish, Welsh, Irish people. In their millions, most of them are not Muslims. So who are they going to vote for? Well, I think they're going to vote for the Workers' Party and for the independents that we are supporting up and down the country. About 100 of them we are supporting. And why would they not? Why would they vote for the guy that did all that and the guy who supported the guy doing all that? This is a matter of simple electoral logic, which journalists either can't or pretend they can't understand. So that would be the first thing I'd say. And I think the second thing I would say is that we are potentially headed to Armageddon. And if we don't get out of this death spiral, then none of this will have been worth arguing over at all. I'm going to make a prediction to you, Andrew. If Keir Starmer becomes the Prime Minister, within 6 months, Britain will be at war. I don't mean a proxy war. I don't mean special forces dressed up as Arabs or Russians, Ukrainians. I mean an actual war with British forces deployed within 6 months of Keir Starmer becoming Prime Minister. And then it's game on, I'm afraid to say.
So that's George Galloway speaking earlier this week, Wednesday, at the launch of their manifesto. I'll put a link up to the full interview, as I will with Farage at thisweek.org.uk on our show page. So that's an interesting prediction, isn't it? We also heard, by the way, Peter Hitchens on GB News saying, yes, this is credible. And he's saying it's extremely dangerous, the policy that we're pursuing. Of course, it's a policy for endless war. It's a policy that benefits the disaster capitalists. And, of course, the idea of endless war is extremely good for the arms manufacturers. So when you can't actually make anything that anyone wants to buy, you just make arms for yourself and you feed them to warmongers, and that seems to be the direction that both Labour and Tory and the World Economic Forum and the other elites that control them are taking and dragging us into. So that's why I'm focusing on these fringe parties, and I wouldn't count the Greens as a fringe party because their net zero policies are, you know, really damaging, as we'll hear in a little while. So on to Putney, and Heiko Koo is standing in Putney. He's someone who's regularly to be seen on a Sunday down at Speaker's Corner. We've had him on the show several times. He does the Marxist tours of London, and he's a candidate in Putney for the Workers' Party at the general election. So I had quite a long chat with him this week about the details behind all of this, but particularly looking at the why it is they're doing these series of things called Putney debates, and we'll be hearing an extract after this. A wide-ranging chat about the absolutely failed state of British politics, but HiCo and the Workers' Party are doing everything they can to make a difference. And one of the points we discuss is this whole idea of having these big TV debates with all the leaders, the top seven leaders. Well, the top seven in terms of party sizes are, I think I'm right in saying, everyone except Galloway, who's eight. And so Galloway's been excluded deliberately from these debates because we've got it's quite clear that if he was there, then he could just destroy Starmer in 5 seconds, and he'd probably destroy Sunak too, and anyone else that he wanted to, because he's such a good orator. So they've got to keep him out, which is absolutely disgusting. And of course, it shows that the press have this kind of oublier. So if there's somebody that they think is standing and a credible candidate with a lot of support, like Jeremy Corbyn, what they can do, or George Galloway, what they can do is just throw them down the chute onto the rocks below, and we don't see anything of them hardly, and don't hardly hear anything about them except usually negative stuff. Anyway, let's have a listen now to sensible, very sensible guy called HiCo Koo, standing for George Galloway's Workers' Party in Putney.
My name's HiCo Koo. I'm a candidate for the Workers' Party in Putney. I've been speaking at Speaker's Corner since 1985, the end of 85. And I'm involved in politics on the left from a socialist standpoint. But I'm opposed to a lot of the restrictions on our freedoms and rights that have been done in the name of Big Pharma, in the name of climate and other things. And therefore, I think I kind of got a bit of a unique position for those of us on the left. And so I think it's worthwhile putting that position to the public during the election. What was the second part?
The timing of the election is very surprising, since the Conservatives are so low in the poll.
Yeah, one of the interesting things was that the main speech that was made by Rishi Sunak in advance of the election was not that damp squib of a speech when he was soaked in the rain, but it was the speech he made after the election victory in Rochdale by George Galloway. And it was to charge onto, and it was quite a coherent speech. And there he declared that society's been riven apart effectively by hate conflict associated with the conflict in Gaza, and warned of the rise of extremism, which Galloway's election supposedly represented. And I think there might be a component in the calculations of the Conservative Party to try to, if you like, maintain the status quo by propping up the Labour Party. Effectively, there are people, I think, behind the scenes who know very well that there is not much difference of any significance between the Conservative Party and the Labour Party, and want the Labour Party to take over as a new face for the same interests that control society, be it the Zionist lobby supporting Israel, or be it big corporations, pharma, big tech, and the rest of them. Because Keir Starmer is actually not offering anything of any difference, and the different policies that are being proposed are relatively insignificant for the fate of society, although they make a number of buzzword proposals, which they would never, almost certainly never introduce regardless. For example, the idea of a national service and so on. The likelihood of that happening is pretty much zero. And therefore, it's simply to pretend that there is some substance to the differences between the Tories and Labour.
We've had this week a rowback by Labour on the policy of child support, which I found quite surprising. They're saying that only the first two kids, just as the Conservative policy now, Rachel Reeves and Angela Rayner are saying yesterday, that only the first two kids will get child benefits. So you do wonder, where are they getting these policies from? They actually seem to be coming more in line with Conservative policies as they get more confident that they're going to win this general election, Labour.
Yeah, and of course the policies that they, even the policies that they accept or they claim they're going to introduce, they will not introduce, or they're not likely to introduce. And this is the pattern of Keir Starmer. That's what he's saying. He's saying, I stood in the election as leader up for the leader of the Labour Party, and I put down whatever was necessary to get elected, and then I did the opposite. And he's saying exactly the same now. Basically, there are five steps to heaven, which he is proposing. I'm not sure that any of them are memorable. I think that's the intention, that you shouldn't remember what they are. And then he makes minor appeals to or tries to get some focus group to advise him on how to capture sections of the Conservative vote. And the VAT question is one of those.
So, I mean, we're nowadays, I mean, if you were to go back, say, you know, even 50 or 100 years, you'd see much more campaigning out in the constituencies where people would actually meet politicians, see them, actually heckle them. Now we've got a very kind of stage managed, manicured approach where actually the politicians themselves even select the journalists to ask the questions. So they know them by name. They call them, the politicians call the journalists by their Christian names.
Yeah.
And they just, there isn't really any room for the public or even independent press to get into these conferences or to ask questions of the politicians. So the whole thing is kind of managed by mass media. I know you have taken some initiative with some colleagues of yours in London to try to get this election back to the public. What are you up to and how are you doing that?
Yeah, back in the day, I mean, you know, I speak at Speaker's Corner. Back in the day, people would do soapbox speaking in their community. And the last time that really was at least emphasised was when John Major defeated the razzmatazz of Neil Kinnock by going onto the street in Brixton on a soapbox and being heckled by a load of lefties. And the point he made there, which was a surprise in the election, was that if you go to the street and you talk to the street, even if you're heckled and argued with, it's more in the original tradition of what democracy is supposed to be about. Because you're calling an election, and it's not about is Starmer or Sunak in power. It's about hundreds of members of parliament who are supposed to be representing their constituents and supposed to be standing up for something themselves, not just machines following a line determined centrally, which is really no different from what they accused the Soviet Union or China of doing. And so when I try to arrange meetings for, I was given a list of meeting rooms by the officer of the council, which we are able to get for free. At least we shouldn't be paying the costs of hiring the room. So we have to pay for lighting and heating and stuff like that. But otherwise, for hiring the room, we don't pay a cost. And so when I attempted to hire rooms, I found there were enormous obstacles in the way, starting with the fact that the renting of rooms in schools and a lot of other institutions that are funded by the government and that are supposed to be available under the Representation of the People's Act 1983, that it has been farmed out to private companies, some relatively small companies, but whatever reason they've been given, because of lack of resources or lack of initiative or whatever reason, the renting of rooms has been largely, or at least around half of the places, farm this out to private companies. And so I got to get faced with this problem. I made sure that because the stipulations are that the room must be available for rent and not already be booked. So in other words, I had to book the rooms under the auspices to identify what dates they are free and to make sure that I can get that room. And then I have to go and say after the event, actually, we shouldn't be paying for this, or better said, you're not allowed to charge us for this. So I've just had that with the library just now, for example, in the public library. We booked a number of meetings at the public library and they were accepted. They sent me a bill a few minutes ago for £950. And I then wrote to the council officer, who then wrote to the library this morning. So he's been very efficient on this. But he did say to me, no one else has ever done this. No one's actually, I mean, in his memory, of course, going back to the 1950s, 60s, 70s, it was the norm for politicians to put themselves in front of the public and for the public to attend meetings, which would have been in local meeting halls or schools, which would have, by part as part of the course, offered these buildings for these hustings events. And there, you know, heckling and argument and debate from the floor would have taken place. The couple of hustings that we have done have been, so far, have been characterized by the selection. Perhaps the most important point was the selection of questions in advance sent in online. Now, I don't agree with that. I think if you're going to have an election debate, the election debate should focus around the people in the room. And this was noticeable last night. That was that in the St. Mary's Church debate, no insult to the person organizing it, but it was entirely based on questions that had been sent in online and selected by the chairperson to be the questions that were discussed. Now, I'm not saying they were terrible questions per se, but it really doesn't give the cut and thrust of debate a chance to develop. And that's why I support the initiative launched by Eilish Jordan, who got together with myself and three other people and decided to create something called the PutneyDebates.uk is the website. And the Putney debates are a sort of revival of the historic debates that took place in 1647, when Cromwell's army decided to debate the future of Britain and the future of democracy. And the question was, do the people have the right to vote, and how should power be exercised, and what's the relationship between property and rights? And so these series of debates that we've organized are with the intent of going into greater depth and providing the people in Putney with perhaps the most comprehensive series of debates during the course of this election. And I think that it could set a standard for how debates should be run in future during elections, because it simply isn't enough for parliamentarians to be elected and then attend this or that meeting or this or that cause, and then the rest of the time do nothing and get their votes based upon television presidential discussions about Sunak and Starmer or whoever the leader is. I think politics needs to go back to the grassroots. And in fact, all the local issues that come up involve some kind of grassroots requests for action. And basically, they would require meetings such as we're holding. So that's the idea, is to rejuvenate democracy during the electoral process in order for people really to have a chance to cross-question the candidates and find out what their fundamental ideas are, whether you agree with them or not.
Yeah, so there's a couple of things here. Firstly, an online debate, if you're sending in questions in online, and even if it is in person, you come along to afterwards, which Bristol City Council also does these now, where you've got to submit questions online beforehand, precludes anybody that is not online, and there are particularly elderly and wise, our elders citizens that just simply don't do this kind of thing. So they're excluded, as well as any developments that are happening actually during the discussion and debate, they're excluded. And also anything that's been in the news for a few days before the discussion and debate, that's also excluded. So this is really a denuded discussion. It's not a genuine discussion at all. What do you make of, then there's also the fact that in these TV debates that we've been having on national television, I noticed that there are only the seven top, they call them top anyway, well, we don't know actually what the top are, but the seven top parties are invited. That's Labour and Conservative, SNP, Plaid Cymru, Green, not sure what they all are. Oh yeah, Reform. That's right.
Yeah.
But George Galloway's party is standing in many, many constituencies across the country. The Workers' Party, and yet they are number eight, and they've been excluded from almost all the ones I've seen anyway of these national debates.
Yes, I had to write to the Evening Standard a few minutes ago, because there they have an article published. Like who the election in Putney, who can I vote for? And then they've got the Tory Party candidate, the Labour Party candidate, and then a list of five candidates says these are the main parties standing. And this is not a newspaper article. This is an online article where they deliberately avoided putting my name down and putting the name of the person standing for Rejoin EU. So how can a newspaper be allowed to present the public, and it's an influential newspaper with a wide readership, even online, be allowed to present the case that there are only five parties standing? Or even though they worded it, and that's why I think it is malicious, because the wording is very specific and it says the main party standing, as if adding two names underneath and two parties underneath would somehow be too much of a strain for the space on their website.
Yeah, why do you think it is that Galloway is seen as a threat then? Because there seems to be deliberate exclusion of George Galloway's Workers' Party from the particularly the mainstream media coverage.
I think they're really scared. I think they're scared that if Galloway's party or the Workers' Party is able to freely express its point of view, and in many constituencies there's a very strong feeling about the issues which George Galloway and the Workers' Party have taken up, particularly over Gaza, then there can be upsets that they don't expect. And the ball can get rolling in terms of challenging the so-called authority of the Labour Party over Labour voters. Anyone who's followed what happened over the last few years knows fully well that Jeremy Corbyn was removed, at least partly, but not only partly, but under a significant amount of influence of the Israel lobby, who were determined to remove him by hook or by crook, using slanders and lies about anti-Semitism. And once they got rid of him and smeared everyone else who they wanted to, then, of course, the anti-Semitism story just quietly disappeared from the Labour Party. Except where if you're, you know, perhaps a Jewish activist who supports Palestine, then you might still be, you know, thrown out of the party at the will of central office. And so the party has been turned into an instrument of power on behalf of big business and of the Israel lobby. And the actual members have been disenfranchised. And so there is a widespread knowledge of this. People know very well that the party has been, its power inside the party has been usurped. And therefore, they're doing everything possible. The combined establishment, the same ones who launched the smear campaigns against Jeremy Corbyn, you know, the Laura Koonsbergs and the entire mainstream media apparatus, are in a conspiracy collectively to not mention the Workers' Party. You know, just like don't mention the war in John Cleese, you know, in the 40 Towers. And that's what we've got. Well, we've got look, a kind of 40 Towers world, you know.
Yeah. Well, look, the Workers' Party is thought of largely as a pro-Palestinian party. But what about domestic policies? Do you have those? Just to ask you about the platform you're standing on.
Yeah, the Workers' Party manifesto argues that the imperialist wars that we're fighting are the consequence of a long background of the history of British imperialism, and Britain needs to purge itself of that imperial background and to call a referendum on NATO membership to end the war, support for the war in Ukraine, and to isolate Israel. And the other thing the Workers' Party stands for is to redistribute wealth to the working classes. That means taking public ownership of whatever industries are necessary. In my opinion, the commanding heights of the economy should be in public ownership. But we can begin with water, electricity, the railways, gas, and move on to those other sections of the economy that need to be taken into public ownership, and empower the working class to administer and manage companies by creating workers' councils of some form or another to allow the workers to participate and to shift private companies as well from under control of shareholders to being under the control of missions determined by the workers and determined by the communities themselves. So what we're basically and also the key questions are, for example, about digital life. You know, cash is being undermined and digital life is taken over. We need to step back from that and move back towards a cash-based community life, and also to oppose the cultural wars that have been fought out, which are detrimental to our communities and our social life. And those are the central elements, I think, that I'm standing on.
Now, I mean, we're looking today at a largely divided Europe, particularly between Russia and the rest of Europe. And I'm you talking there about leaving NATO. There are all sorts of warnings going out about the provocations of the NATO countries using Ukraine as a proxy, actually hitting some important strategic Russian sites, such as air bases where their nuclear bombers are based, early warning radars. And command centers actually in Russia itself. Now, Russia is increasingly seeing this as a NATO attack rather than just a Ukraine. In fact, many of these bases are not even relevant to the Ukraine war that supposedly Ukraine's hitting. So what do you make of the way that this is developing? So, I mean, there's some in Russia are saying, well, we should hit a few European countries with a nuke. That will soon shut them up.
Yeah, the British seem determined to be belligerent advocates of Ukrainians firing British weapons or American weapons or German or French weapons into Russia. And this is an act of desperation, illustrating that Russia has effectively won the war, bar the peace deal. But they're scuppering any possibility of a peace deal. And that's why they held this absurd event in Switzerland a couple of days ago. Ukraine will lose this war, and they will lose territory, the territory based in the Donbass, and the Crimea will have to be accepted that it is part of Russia. This is a simple fact, and everybody knows this. Zelensky knows this. The West knows this. But, of course, they can't admit that they failed. And so more and more Ukrainians and Russian men will die in the trenches. And this is what we've got, a trench warfare. We need to get out of this war. We need to make peace with Russia, peace with China, and bring our societies closer together, exchange goods, exchange resources. And that will raise the living standards of the people, rebuild the pipelines that were blown up, and facilitate an international cooperation and exchange between the countries of the world economically and between the people of the world, particularly the working classes of the world, socially and culturally.
And what have you got to say to anybody who's thinking maybe about voting for the Workers' Party, but understanding that in the first past the post system, there's really no point?
Well, you can argue that about any political party. I mean, in fact, where there are big majorities, for example, the first past the post system might well lead people to say, I am going to vote for something different. And there is no foregone conclusion about which party wins. Sometimes people make up their mind on the day. I think people are volatile in their political direction. If they're voting determined by what's on television, well, then they probably shouldn't, to be honest with you, they're not making an informed decision. They should get involved in the local hustings debates. That's why we've also organized so many of them. We've posted them also online so that people can watch the video debates. And I don't think that's happened anywhere really around the country. There might be one or two, but we've already posted two full videos of the events of the hustings, and we will be posting many more so that people can actually make their decision based, even if they weren't at the meeting, they can observe the discussions that took place. They're in-depth and detailed and covering many subject matters, and they will get more in-depth as we go along. And in that way, they can make up their minds based on a properly informed, you know, there was a lot of discussion over the last years about informed consent in medicine. Well, informed consent in medicine can also apply to informed consent in politics. Are you actually informed about what the policies are, the programs are, the philosophies behind them? Are you informed about that? And once you're informed about that, you can make a decision as to vote for one party or another. But without that background information, it's the manipulation of people in the typical propagandist style of the advertising elites and the large corporations.
Yeah, it almost does seem as if this is a private sector election. I hate to say it. You're up against people like the Reform. Now, they've had an enormous surge, at least in opinion polls. What do you put that down to? And do you think Workers' Party, maybe later in this campaign, not long to go now, but can match it?
Yes, I mean, the Reform Party in our area, I don't think it's got a lot of traction. I could be wrong, but I don't think it might attract some former Tory voters, but I don't think much more than that.
Well, yeah, but for them to go past the Conservatives is pretty extraordinary.
Well, this is the poll. I mean, okay, this is local. This is local. I'm talking about on a national basis. The reform. Well, this is the opinion polls, and I think they're rigged. They don't ask people, would you vote for the Workers' Party, for example? They can give the excuse that the Workers' Party is a national party, but on the other side, reform doesn't even have a member of parliament. Whereas at least we've got George Galloway as a member of parliament, and so the fact they're not putting George Galloway on the listings is illustrative of the manipulation that polls are used for in order to shape and nudge people to behave and to vote in a certain way. And probably reform has been pushed forward precisely because they saw that George Galloway was doing well. Either Nigel Farage was astute enough to see that the polarization is quite significant, and that the support for the traditional mainstream parties is wavering and is insecure. And then decided to do it, or somebody else made that decision on his behalf, because suddenly out of the blue, long after the election had begun, Nigel Farage suddenly threw his weight into the game. So you have to ask what makes such a decision, given the fact he had decided in advance of this not to do this. So suddenly he changes his mind. Well, either he's a clever tactician who's been informed by the grassroots. He's got money. He can find things out. He can identify what the type of mood in society is. He can get opinion polls and special focus groups to inform him and report to him. And obviously something there jinxed him into standing. So perhaps it's the polarization that is going towards the Workers' Party, or potentially would go to the Workers' Party. You could also ask people who are Labour voters, would you vote for an alternative candidate, for example, Jeremy Corbyn in Islington or Feinstein in Camden and St Pancras or whatever the area is. And I think you'd find there, if you ask such a speculative question, that you'll find a very large number of Labour voters and working class voters disillusioned with the existing system would be prepared to vote for another party. And so that's why I think a reform step, or better said, Nigel Farage has stepped in and also been promoted as the alternative to the Conservative Party, because they don't want to let the Conservative ethos and philosophy disappear without reforming it into a new, reforging it into a new format that will allow conservatism, British conservatism, to reemerge like the phoenix under a Starmer government. I think that's the game.
Interesting. Look, finally, the context of this is that these Putney debates that are happening in Putney, where you're standing. Is that right? You're in Putney?
That's right, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, that discussion was at a time of the English Civil War. I know you do these historical tours in London, don't you?
Yeah. Yeah.
The point of the Civil War, I think, is not taught well in British schools, which was a sort of battle between the feudal classes and the new merchant classes, you know, the capitalist, emerging capitalist classes, which the capitalist classes won. And then, of course, there was Charles. It's all interesting. In the background of this, we've got, of course, King Charles III, where the Civil War was all about Charles I and Charles II. So yeah. Do you think there's any, any reflection in today's politics of what was going on in the Civil War?
Yes, the if you like, the new interests of the poor being represented through the army council debates and through the levellers demanding, some sections of them demanding the right to vote for all men at that time, regardless of property, brought forth all the questions that have vexed politics since the struggles for democracy began. And it, if you like, centuries ahead of its time, the debates that are still relevant were thrown up in 1647 during these few days of meetings that took place, intensively discussing the issues of the day. And people produced pamphlets and statements and arguments. And it was a very sophisticated debate, which was ahead of its time. They couldn't really escape from the property relations of their era. And there was no possibility of a real socialist society being established in a time like that. But nevertheless, in the 19th century, the conditions had changed. Urbanization developed. the majority of the population moved to the cities, and from that time onwards, the working classes have been the decisive force in politics, or at least potentially the decisive force in politics. And I think that's the case not only in Britain, but around the world today. So the Putney debates in that respect from 1647 can inform what happens today. And if you like, still reflects the same crises, but in a different way, because the working class are now so powerful that the demands that they make, if they really exercise democracy, will inevitably challenge the property relations dominating society. So the Putney debates are at putneydebates.uk. You can see the debates when they take place. And even while they're taking place, we'll stream them online as well.
Look, one question that's come out of that for me is this idea of back in the 1600s, not everyone was allowed to vote. We've now got over a million people who do not have voter ID. So even if they do decide to go and vote, which they probably won't, but if they do, they'll be turned away.
Yeah. I mean, the political process is farcical. And one of the aspects of campaigning this election is to reveal how farcical it is, so, and to reveal the limitations of it. And so that's why, one, the Putney debates, two, inside the debates, I point out to people, because a lot of people say, what are you going to do about this? What are you going to do about this in this community or that community? I pointed out to people, the MP does not decide these things. All the MP can do is put their face to a campaign and support it. Or, for example, there's a case in Wimbledon Park where Wimbledon Lawn Tennis want to take over a big park and make some huge complex there. And the people there are protesting. Well, what can an MP actually do? An MP can, sit in front of the bulldozer as a symbolic act. But otherwise, the MP is quite limited in what they're able to do. So you need to understand about how to increase the power of the people from below. And that's the reason why I'm standing in this election. And if I was to win the election, I would continue with that frame of thinking in Parliament itself and expose the limits of Parliament and the need for popular power from below.
Well, I hope you'll have time to continue your Marxist tours as well. Hi, Koku. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
So what about these Putney debates? Well, interesting, aren't they? So let's have a listen to a part of one. Here's an extract from one of the Putney debates that was going on this week in the church in Putney, where they have all the candidates in there discussing each night. They're talking about generally different areas, questions. And this question was about the ULEZ, this whole idea of charging people with older cars to go around so the people who are rich with new cars don't have to pay.
We're being suffocated by the traffic czars who are controlling the inability of traffic to move around Putney. We've got bridges closed, narrowed off, blocked and made unusable. What is each county going to do to stop Putney being suffocated?
I could say no more. Excellently asked. And we're now going to pass for the final time to Lee.
Excellent. Thank you. Well, I was accused of saying naughty things about Sadiq Khan. I've apologised for calling him the drip thing, but I won't apologise for the sentiment of the damage I think he's done to this great city. And that's by being forced along into a controlling agenda which has led to many of our streets being tied up. And also, let's look at the bridge, the number one issue which is making us congested, Hammersmith Bridge. Now, I didn't know until I looked into the detail that TfL normally pay 85% of bridge repairs. When this thing came up, Sadiq Khan ducked it. He ran off. He got his Labour apologists to say, oh, it's the government, let the government do it. No, the government had proposed a third of the cost of this and bailed out TfL to the tune of almost 7 billion. Now, bear in mind, TfL already control and manage and run six bridges in London, from Tower Bridge to Lambeth Bridge. I say, make Hammersmith Bridge the complete responsibility of TfL. The mayor has the responsibility and the strategic authority to make this work. Also bear in mind, he's spending 1.2 billion on a Silvertown tunnel crossing, because that's important. Why not this part of London? Why is East London so important? So I say, number one, get the mayor, sit down with him, I'll sit down with him, regardless of what he thinks of me, and say, we need to have this thing sorted out. You take control, you open it.
Thank you. Hammersmith Bridge is one major part of the gridlock that we see in Putney. Anyone trying to go through Putney any day of the week will see exactly this. I agree, it's a major issue. So on Hammersmith Bridge, it's a uniquely expensive bridge because it's a heritage bridge that was built before Suspension Bridge. It was a prototype. It cost 60 and then 120 million to repair it, refurbish it when it was first closed. If the government had done the right thing and stepped in and said, this is a large amount of money, it's more than the local council, Hammersmith and Fulham Council's budget for the year, of course it's a government issue. Of course it's a national transport route. It's an embarrassment internationally that it's remained closed. It's being covered in the New York Times. So the government should have stepped in then, and in the 5 years it's been closed, there's been a task force that's had literally no task, no action. I've had protest days in Putney, in London, I've held debates. I've taken this constantly to the government to say the impact that it's having on us here in Putney is intolerable. But will the government do anything? No. They've sat on a business plan delivered by the council since December 2022, and now it will cost £250 million. You cannot leave this to the council or to TfL, it will bankrupt them to do it. The government has to step in and take the action that's been left to it. I will continue to campaign relentlessly on this. When the Speaker sees me in the House of Commons, he says, have they built your bridge yet? Because I've raised it so many times in Parliament. And yet the Tories have had the last 5 years to sort this out, and they haven't. Okay. It's time for a change.
Thank you.
Hammersmith, I mean, it's farcical. You could build a bridge on the side of Hammersmith Bridge within a few weeks. If the army wants to build a bridge to cross a river, they'll build a bridge. They did that even in the Second World War. So the idea that we can't build the most elementary infrastructure is illustrative of the paralysis within government that is entirely in hock to big business interests who want to squeeze for money, or who want to squeeze their officials for money. As far as the traffic is concerned, remove the restrictions on the speed on traffic to 30 miles an hour from 20 miles an hour. This is insane. The whole city, I go in second gear in my car, all around the city. And then you get across this road, it's not just Putney Bridge, you go from Putney Bridge to Hammersmith, it's gridlocked all the way.
Yeah.
Because they put cycle lanes that are unnecessary in that area. There are plenty of matchmaking
yes.
going on.
Yeah.
Cycle lanes along there, and you've got to go 20 miles an hour. It's insanity. And therefore what's happening is that the whole city's been governed by, and this is where we're going to disagree, by a greenwashing lobby utilising a campaign against cars and petrol cars and diesel cars, which can easily fit catalytic converters, in order to promote new industries where they're making billions and billions out of, like electric cars and so on.
Yes, we disagree. So, okay. When I first moved to Putney High Street was chock-a-blocked, and it was actually the reason I joined the Green Party, because the air pollution, like, I could taste the air. And I thought, there's something wrong here. It was 9 years ago. Fast forward, nothing's changed. We've got one bridge that is causing the Lower Richmond Road. It is chock-a-blocked, and I actually just live off the Lower Richmond Road, and I travel every single day cycling, which is way quicker than every single car. And I'm reading that in. We've got 7,000 to 8,000 people dying prematurely every year because of the toxic air pollution in
lies.
That's true.
It's
the Royal College of Surgeons. Look it up. So, in the 1800s, 1700s, 1800s, the average speed in London was 8 miles an hour. 2024, the average speed is 7 miles an hour. Let's look at the problem. The problem is we've got too many cars on the road for a very small city, crammed city. Right? We need cheap, reliable public transport that's safe for everybody. Get people in the cars, get people cycling, people get healthy, get rid of this toxic air, and then we can get the city moving again. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, so I'm sorry I started off slow. I'm going to get a bit fired up about this. Lee is wrong. Totally wrong. 85%. You're talking about Chelsea Bridge and you're talking about the paint. You're not talking about maintenance at all. That's rubbish. Central government has always paid 90 to 95% on those bridges, and that's just a fact. You're wrong. Okay?
It's
you're wrong. Just serious. Fleur, you're also wrong. You're raising it all the time. No, you're not. I looked, dug it out. You raised it 9 times in 2021, 5 times in 2022, 4 times in 2023, and once this year. So it's not, you've given up. You've given up. It's ridiculous.
Fleur, you're also wrong. It's actually faster to walk than it is to cycle on Lower Richmond Road, and I've got a video proving it. I literally was walking. I live on Lower Richmond Road as well. I'm walking along, and I thought, this is insane. I got off the bus, I walked, I filmed it. I went faster than every single car. That's how bad it is. I had a meeting today with a bunch of women in their 80s, and I said, and they said, what are you going to do about Hammersmith Bridge? I said, look, this is the only thing that's going to happen. We have to have people living in Putney. We're the ones dealing with it. We have to have us protesting. Will you protest? And they all said, in their 80s, yes, you get us out there, we're going to protest. I said, right, let's do it, and let's get the damn bridge open. So that, vote for me, I will get that bridge open within a year. That's my promise. Do it. Let's open it.
Right. Okay, I'm very glad to say that if you want to continue that discussion, and you're interested, Putney are holding hustling tomorrow at St Mary's Church, near Putney Bridge. So you can hear it all over again, that Johnson from Putney Society. Putney Society is here to find out how to not do, or even to do, a hustling. So.
An extract from the Putney election hustings, the Putney debates, from earlier this week. The question there about the traffic czars and the way that cities are now being managed, and car drivers are being told, no, it's not the wealthy that are being hit by this tax, it's the poorer people, which shows you that it's not really Labour anymore, and it's not a Labour Party. They're not looking after poor people, they're actually looking after rich people, the Labour Party, Mayor Carnham, people like that. Anyway, so Putney Debates is a link up on our show page. I'll put a link up to the whole series of Putney Debates going on in the final couple of weeks before the general election date. Also now then, Keir Starmer, what about, he did a very interesting, I think, press conference about defence, which we've taken clips from over the last few weeks. Here he talks about, he's asked a question about the steel industry and whether that affects Britain's national security.
Having a thriving domestic steel industry is a very important part of Britain's national security. The Labour Party has criticised the £500 million deal that the government has done with Tata Steel to keep Port Talbot going because it will involve the loss of thousands of jobs in turning that site green. But you are potentially about to enter government as Prime Minister. Would you continue that deal that hasn't quite been completed, or would you rip it up and start again with the potential risk of Tata Steel walking away completely from the UK?
I'm very concerned about the situation in Port Talbot. I'm very concerned about the situation in Scunthorpe, because it is very important for us that we have the capability in the United Kingdom to produce our own steel. And that is on the line in relation to what's going on in Port Talbot and in Scunthorpe. So I went to Port Talbot myself, as you would expect, to talk to the workforce there, to talk to the trade unions, to talk to the management, and to talk to the ownership, to have confidential discussions with them, because my number one issue has been to save those jobs that are there, that are at risk, and I've looked in the eyes of those that are vulnerable to losing their jobs, but also the importance of the steel industry. What I wouldn't do is what Rishi Sunak did, which is when Mark Drakeford, as First Minister of Wales, asked Rishi Sunak as Prime Minister for a phone call to discuss jointly how they could save those jobs. Rishi Sunak said, I'm too busy. That's shocking. I went to Scunthorpe, I've spoken to the management of Scunthorpe and to the workforce at Scunthorpe. Their issue is whether they can get an electric arc furnace in quickly. I've understood the issues and the problems. I'm absolutely committed that we can overcome those hurdles with them. So in relation to Port Talbot and to Scunthorpe, I'm absolutely vested in not just saving those jobs, important though that is, but also to the future of steel making in this country. Because my fear is if we lose it, we'll never get it back, and that will be a backward step. Thank you, Jim. Amy from The Telegraph.
Thank you. Amy Gibbons.
Labour leader Keir Starmer there, probably be our new Prime Minister, and that means, according to the Galloway, war within 6 months. We shall see. Interesting prediction, I must admit. I think he could be right, but we're not really getting that. Our story hasn't done the rounds. Quite a lot of people have seen it, but I think it should be clear. You know, they're saying if the mainstream media seem to want Labour to win, and so maybe they're just simply ignoring this one, because this might be, if it does come to pass, this is going to be a feather in Galloway's cap, even if it is horrifying for millions of people, a war, because he said, oh, I told you so. Look, you know, no one listens to me. And this is the press, of course, the mass media that doesn't listen to him, who insult him a lot of the time when they're interviewing him. So that was Keir Starmer speaking a couple of weeks ago at a press conference, election conference, about his national security and defence policy. Well, what about those old-time lefties like the film director Ken Loach, made all sorts of brilliant films, Land and Freedom just being one that comes to mind. And he had this to say a couple of years ago about Keir Starmer when he first came to power, and he saw him saying all the things he was saying to become Labour leader, and then basically everything falling away. But what does Ken Loach, film director, make of this new Prime Minister? It looks like we're about to get.
Murdoch can put his arm around Starmer and say, you're one of us. You can vote Labour now. And deliver, this is the key thing, deliver the working class, hand and bound, to Murdoch and his pals, the establishment, the BBC, the Guardian and the rest. And then the Guardian will say, well, you know, you could have done a little bit more, Keir Starmer. You could have given a few more bob to the health service. You could have done this, you could have done that. But too late, you know. I received a letter, like many, probably thousands of people have, from the Labour Party, saying that they had prescribed certain organisations that were there to support people who'd been unjustly expelled or suspended. Of course, I'd support those organisations. There is a witch hunt against the left, and the party leadership made the prescription act retrospectively. So if you'd ever been a member, or not even a member, a supporter, or endorsed any of these organisations, then you were expelled yourself. I mean, that's not normal, I understand, in the law that you make. This misdemeanor is now a crime, and you're guilty if you ever did it in the past. Laws don't act retrospectively in that way. However, Starmer has no regard for due process. He has no regard for natural justice. He's simply concerned with expelling the left. So I decided to take no part in this charade, and I didn't give them the satisfaction of a reply. You have to treat these attacks as a badge of honour. If they come for you, it shows they rate you. So I think that's the way we have to look at it. Yeah, and come on, you know, abuse us, because you just reveal who you are. It's water off a duck's back to me. We have nothing to worry about. They're the ones who should be in the dock. So I'd say to anyone, you know, and particularly the comrades in Young Labour, where does a badge of honour? They're bastards. Don't give them the time of day. If I were Jeremy, I would say, I'm not coming back. I'm going to hold you to account from the back benches. You're going to see what leadership really is. You are no Labour Party leader. There will be no Party of the People under your leadership. I'd hammer him. I wouldn't want to get back in. I'd hammer him as an independent. I think those who are in the party have got to fight every inch. You know, occupy them, hold them to account. But do it in the knowledge that the media probably won't report you. I mean, the Jewish members, who are now four or five times more likely to be expelled than non-Jewish members, fought taints of anti-Semitism. Jewish members who have fought anti-Semitism all their life. I mean, it's so bizarre, you know, you couldn't make it up. It doesn't get a mention.
Ken Loach there, speaking about the new Prime Minister we're probably going to get in very soon, a guy called Keir Starmer. So on to go past our election coverage a little bit, but it's related to that, and this is to do with the arrest of Bristol pastor Dia Moodley up at Bristol University. He's now had messages from the police to say there'll be no further action. The actual events were he's preaching up there about abortion up near the university, and he's pushed off of he's got a kind of little tiny step ladder thing he stands on to do his preaching, and then the kids around him, or the students who are having a go at him, stand on his signs He is then arrested, as if basically the university can just tell the police, oh, arrest this person, and the police don't actually do any kind of investigation. But anyway, he's finally found out that the signs that he uses, which notify the number of abortions, which he calls murder, that happens every day or every week or every month, the whole lot of it was all just given to the university, and they were told, well, you can just put it in the bin. So his property is given by the police to the university to throw away.
This was in late April, and so I got arrested. I spent 13 hours in a prison cell. Broke my finger, like I said, whilst preaching. Well, I didn't break my finger. I got assaulted. You know, my finger was broken as a result of that. I was released on bail 13 hours later, and part of the bail requirement was that up until I get interviewed, I wasn't allowed to preach near any university building. And our legal team had a real problem with that because, you know, which university buildings are we talking about? They're dotted all over Bristol. So they were not very clear about that. But anyway, that wasn't the big problem for us. Went back for the interview, presented our legal case, and the police officer who was investigating it actually said to me, she said, I've seen the CCTV footage. You've been treated very badly here. We see how the people have tried, how the students have planned to pull you off the ladder. You could have fallen onto the oncoming traffic. You could have been seriously hurt or killed. And they're going to go looking for these students now. But like with most things, people put a hoodie over their head, so wear a mask. And that's what the students were doing. They had hoodies, they had masks on. You can't identify them. So the case has been dropped. But what's happened subsequent to that is I tried to recover my signboards from the police because they confiscated it during my arrest. And I wrote to them and said, I'd like my signboards back now because I need to use them. These signs have been with me for the last 5 to 6 years. I need to use them. And I wasn't getting any response. And then the officer who was investigating the case wrote to me and said, Mr. Woodley, we're very sorry to say that our officers gave your signs to the university. And when she tried to call the university had disposed of it. And she said, I don't know why the constabulary has done this. I really apologize on behalf of the constabulary. Here is the process in which you can complain, and here is the process for which you can get compensation. So clearly this officer who was investigating it, obviously she closed the case and said there's no case against me. And she can't understand why the constabulary has made a decision to destroy something or give my property to the university. I'm yet to hear from them. I've lodged the complaint. I'm yet to hear from them. I did speak to the university in the last few days. I emailed the head of security, and he said that on the day of my arrest, actually, the police had given him the signs and said to the staff at the university, can you put this in the bin? And that's exactly what the university did. They took my signs and put it in the bin. And again, these are signs with my scriptures on it. It's like taking my Bible and putting it in the bin.
Well, in a way, dear, you see, I know it's upsetting, but, you know, this could be, it could be your watch, it could be your mobile phone. The idea that the police are actually taking your property off you, giving it to someone who has called the police because their people are assaulting you, and this is not the job of the police to collaborate with people who are assaulting you, steal your property, and ask for it to be put in the bin. This is not the job of the police.
Absolutely. This has further widened the gap between our Christian community and the constabulary. We're supposed to trust these people in uniform. They wear the uniform, they take the constable's oath, and we always appeal to them when they come to us. We remind them, you have an oath to keep the law, to make sure that the peace is being kept. But we're finding out more and more that these who are wearing the uniform, they cannot be trusted. It's just common sense. You don't even have to learn law or to go to a police school to learn this. This is common sense that the property doesn't belong.
So, do these police act for the university? Are they employed by the university?
Well, I think the university is a big player in the city, I've come to understand. I think they're major hitters in the city. I think that without doubt, I watched the officer. He went into this building called Beacon House. Representatives of the university spoke to him. Less than 5 minutes, he was out and he arrested me. No questions asked, nothing. Put your hands out, took my sign away, arrest, put me in handcuffs, put me in the car. And I thought, hang on a moment. He didn't speak to me, he didn't question me, he didn't ask me to verify details, nothing. Bang on, just like that, I got arrested. So I think there are major players, there are major influences in the city, and that's scary for us. It's absolutely scary.
Well,
so
yeah,
it's scary on me.
Well, the most worrying thing, in a way, is that there are literally many thousands of young people under their so-called care, this university. Yeah. But anyway, look, thanks for the update. Can you just let listeners know whereabouts they can find you, both online and in the flesh, so to speak?
Yeah, in the flesh. In the flesh, we're at a place called Romney Avenue, Spirit of Life Reformed Baptist Church, Romney Avenue in Lockleys. That's BS79ST. You can find me on YouTube, my sermons from the church, or my public preaching on Spirit of Life Reformed Baptist Church. That's the YouTube sermons. There's hundreds or thousands of sermons there. Or you can find us at spiritoflife.org.uk. And on Facebook, Spirit of Life, Reformed Baptist Church.
Okay, dear Moodley, thanks very much for joining us.
Appreciate you, Paul.
Okay, nice one. Cheers, dear. That's Pastor Dia Moodley there, and as he explains, he still does his little churchy thing up in Lockleys every Sunday, and you can see his preaching. He's been, unwisely in my view, he's been having a go at the Muslims, but of course you're actually, freedom of speech means freedom to say things that you disagree with, or, yeah, I mean, so, yeah, he's absolutely right to criticise the police for taking his personal property and handing it over to the university to just destroy. I mean, that's not the police's job. Now we have Isaac Rose, finally, before the break. Isaac Rose, he came down, he's just done a book called Rentier City about Manchester gentrification. But he had some really interesting things to say about private equity firms and also about the 20% annual returns that they're getting for investing in student accommodation. And these have, of course, all links to the university we were just hearing about.
So PBSA, purpose-built student accommodation, is regarded by investors as what's known as like an asset class investment, which is basically a really good investment, I think. There's actually a really fascinating guy in Manchester who has campaigned against. They're building a 40-story PBSA block in Manchester near this guy's house. I mean, this guy's not like, he's an ex Silicon Valley investor who lived in city centre Manchester, but he doesn't like PBSA, but he also is quite an expert on the planning system and kind of how these things have been pushed through, and he also sometimes goes as a secret shopper to investor conferences for PBSA. And basically when he's at these investor conferences there were like three things, I think, where PBSA is basically seen as a really safe investment. So one, in the planning system it's classed as a sui generis development, which is basically, it's this kind of legalistic term that means its own inner class of its own. So basically, if it's sui generis, it's not commercial, it's not residential, it's its own thing, which basically means that they can circumvent minimum space standards, which is, you know, student accommodation very, very small. From an investor's point, a developer's point, you can put more people paying rent into a smaller space. So that automatically increases the yields you can get. So that's one thing. Two, they're basically tax neutral. So the operation of a PBSA block is, he explained it to me, it's called the OpCo-PropCo split. So the OpCo is the company, so it's basically two companies within one. One company is the operations company, so they manage the lettings, the properties, they're who your student will pay the rent to and so on. The PropCo is the property company, so they own the building. And basically, and I think this is actually, within big developers, this is a pretty common corporate structure now, but they basically move money between these two companies to kind of minimise or move to zero any tax liabilities. So they're able to basically hide any profit so that they pay no tax. So that also means that there's a kind of added incentive. And then the third thing, particularly around PBSA, is the sort of policy context, affordability context. You know, rising in affordability means that more people are being pushed into PBSA, You know, the kind of ultimately, that was the other thing, ultimately the kind of, there's a policy context that backs, the state is backing student loans, so the rent is actually backed by the state. So from an investor's point of view, you know, it will pay no tax, you can put as many people in it as you possibly can, and ultimately if it goes bust, the state is going to pay you out. So it's a really, really great investment. And you can kind of see, I think you can see PBSA almost as like the cutting edge of actually the whole build-to-rent sector. And in more subtle ways, you know, that those things, those kind of three things are apparent in, you know, the build-to-rent block. But student accommodation is like the absolute golden, you know, midpoint of all this stuff. And that basically means that, you know, investors want to invest in PBSA. They're not going to invest in, you know, even, you know, family housing, because why would you when you can get... And apparently the return on capital is 20%, which he was like, that's like higher than tech. It's like, you know, it's the best thing you can put your money in. And within 5 years, you'll get it all back. So actually, even if within 10 years these buildings fall down, the original investors made their money and doubled it. So it's really perverse, basically, but also exactly what the whole system is set up to reward.
Private rental market, basically, sort of part of their portfolio is increasingly, like, seeing huge amounts of money kind of from private equity going into there. There's an interesting quote here from someone there. Institutional private capital can play an important role in providing high-quality housing stock across the UK, particularly in the private rented sector, which is significantly undersupplied today, said James Heppel, head of European real estate at Blackstone. To what extent, I mean, you kind of talked about the two circuits of capital, right? To what extent do you see this huge flood of capital coming from private equity as symptomatic of as a lack of opportunities in productive capital investment, first of all, and secondly, you know, is this actually going to accelerate the trends we've been seeing so recently? Are we now going to get a supercharged version of what you've been describing?
I think you're probably right that it is, you know, for whatever reason, you know, capital is more interested in this because it creates higher yield than, you know, doing anything productive or useful, like, you know, decarbonising or whatever. but there's a political framework that's been put in place to mean that that is kind of where the incentives are going. And that probably is... you know, that's the thing about the neoliberal thing, is that the kind of political, legalistic state framework has been used in the kind of role of the public sector and the state to change the, you know, it's not been retreated, it's been kind of modified to kind of change the kind of, you know, the way in which the economy is working. I think, yeah, it probably will get a lot worse if these actors move into the housing market. I think it goes back to the thing about PBSA, that there are, you know, and it goes back to this thing of like all the incentives, the legalistic framework, the fact that the government won't tackle private landlordism, you know, private landlordism that was deliberately created in the 88 Housing Act to create a profitable private rent sector. The fact that, you know, no one's going to fund council house building or remunicipalisation or anything like that. It just means that the framework within everything is operating tends towards, one, this kind of affordability crisis. But then at the same time, the only solution that is kind of entertained in policy circles is by a massive expansion in supply funded by private equity, because the other things are not considered. So that means that, you know, almost by us talking about how bad the housing crisis is, the discursive framework has been set for, you know, ripping up planning regulations, building a massive expansion in build-to-rent supply, high-quality rental housing. it's like, you know, the framework is in place to allow this to happen, and unless you were to change the political economy of this, you know, I think this is the direction things are going.
Yeah, go on. I said other people.
So, just like you say, it's always going to frame this as an issue of shortage of supply. But you see that as actually being the issue, because I mean, there's more empty homes than homeless people in the UK, right? There is actually. I mean, obviously, the thing with urbanisation is, I guess, then perhaps there is a lack of housing in the places where you need housing, where the jobs are, like London and so on and so on. But like, I feel like it's less an issue of supply and more an issue of ownership, right? Like, to what extent is private landlordism actually part of the reason why there's... Because the way they frame it now is like, well, there's an issue in the private rental market, like there's not enough supply. It's like, well, if more people could afford houses, there wouldn't be so much demand in the private rental market, right? Because it wouldn't be all being hoarded by private landlords.
Seems like it might be more of a comment than a question. Which is fine, but does it really need an answer?
I would agree with you, basically. Yeah. I think the supply argument has been the perfect tool for, like, real estate activists, basically property developer activists, to say, look at this crisis we're facing. The only solution is to rip up planning regulations and allow property developers to do whatever they want. Whereas actually you can kind of take it back and say, well, why, you know, private landlordism, destruction of the public sector, housing, etc., etc. is like, yeah, but it's really, you know, I don't think on the left we've been very good at combating that, basically. I think it's slightly taken us all a bit by surprise. But, you know, this is clearly the framework that's going to govern the urban agenda of the incoming Labour administration, unfortunately. And you know, if you look at somewhere like Manchester, run by Labour Council, you know, the YIMBY capital of Britain, you can see why this is almost prefiguring, you know, I think what Reeves and Starmer are keen to see happen in other places.
That's Isaac Rose there. He's the author of a book on gentrification. It's called Rentier City, Manchester and Gentrification. He was speaking at the Bristol Transformed event a couple of weeks ago. And fascinating guy too. I put the full version of that up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. I've already done a YouTube of it. If you're listening for it, the entire talk you can hear.
Stop you, what you're doing. The officer will pull you over just when he's...
Jesus' Hands Were Kind Hands, a nice little tiny little song, which I can remember singing as a kid as well, in our, I think that was in the junior school, I can remember, so maybe it was infant school, I don't know, but super song nevertheless. Then you've got KRS-One, that is The Sound of the Police, a bit of hip-hop, and finally Fatboy Slim with Right Here, Right Now. So welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show with me, Tony Gosling. No Martin Summers this week. We have a pre-recorded programme, still broadcasting from PRSC, but Dave's away this week, so just having another one of these. Hopefully you'll find it useful, interesting, not quite so much cut and thrust between me and Martin, sadly, but we'll be back next week, inshallah. So the website for this programme is thisweek.org.uk. You'll find everything there, including the longer show clips and various things we've had already in the programme, and we're about to have, you'll find the longer clips there at thisweek.org.uk tonight. And so let's crack on with Norman Finkelstein He's Israeli. He wrote a book called The Holocaust Industry, one of the first books that shocked me about the exaggeration, the lies to do with the Holocaust. Basically, people writing about their experiences under Nazi Germany that turned out not to have actually even been there. So there is an industry behind it. And this, of course, is just lies. Now, it's not to say that the Holocaust didn't happen at all. But the point is, what is a fraud is exaggerating these things and trying to make up stories, make up people just to make money. So here's Finkelstein giving his ideas. I found a really interesting answer this to a great question about whether or not it's a tipping point that we're coming to with Israel's popularity around the world and this whole idea of the credibility of the nation as a whole. It's been a lot of restraint by the Arab countries, seeing there's all sorts of provocations going on, particularly with Hezbollah. They are hitting back a bit, but this week we had Hezbollah's leader and Nasrallah Hezbollah's leader this time saying that that they can hit anywhere in Israel now, because they've had an invasion. I think it was 2006 the Israelis invaded Lebanon, and ever since then the Lebanese have been preparing for war, so they're absolutely ready to fight. They have a bit of an economic disaster going on, of course. That's the banksters behind that, but when it comes to fighting the Israelis, I don't think there's going to be much of a there'll be a contest, quite obviously, but of course the Israelis have nuclear weapons, but the Americans, I think, would have to come in to help the Israelis if anyway. Look, I'll stop waffling on. Let's have a listen to specifically to Norman Finkelstein talking about this, the author of The Holocaust Industries and many other books on the Israeli-Palestine conflict.
We may be now at a tipping point that up until October 7th, I'm talking about the mainstream public political arena, the question of Israel went back as far as 1967, which is to say the legitimacy of Israel was accepted by the international community as a Jewish state. However, the issue in contention was the status and future of the occupied Palestinian territories. Since October 7th, I would say, given the death and destruction on an astronomical scale of the death and destruction that Israel has wreaked on Gaza, and the fact that now it has pinned to its lapel the scarlet letter of genocide, the G for genocide, the whole legitimacy of the state of Israel as a Jewish state has been called into question. From 1967 afterwards, Israel as a Jewish state was accepted. The question was the status of the occupied Palestinian territories. Since October 7th, the legitimacy of the state itself has been called into question. So now we're back in 1948, whether Israel as a state has a legitimate right to exist. And you can see that in many manifestations, that there's now a tension. Are we talking about 67? Or are we talking about 48? Are we talking about the occupied Palestinian territories? Or are we talking about that whole parcel of land from the river to the sea? And you see that very vividly in the South African position. If you read the South African documents, not the documents, if you look at the oral proceedings of South Africa at the ICJ, there have been two sets of oral proceedings. The first person who speaks, I can't remember his name now. I have it right here. So you know, since I have the papers here, I might as well just get his name correctly. Mr. Madonsela, Madonsela. When he begins each of the two oral proceedings, he goes back to 48. He says, this has been a racist, illegal state from the get-go. When I first heard him say that, because the proceedings began in January, mid-January, January 17th, I said, no, don't go there. You're going to undermine the case. Let's just stick to Gaza. Let's not throw Israel into question, because you're going to lose half the judges on the court. But he questioned the entire legitimacy of what some people call the Zionist project or the state of Israel. However, the South Africans always state in all of their public declarations that they support the two-state settlement. So my point is, you could see there's a tension there. Mm. Are we talking about 1948, namely the whole legitimacy of the state of Israel has been called into question? Or are we talking about 1967, Israel as is, where is the Palestinian state next to Israel? So I would say you are correct that beginning October 7th, the legitimacy, I should say, and its aftermath, October 7th, the genocidal war in Gaza, the entire legitimacy of the state of Israel has now been called into question by the international community. And it's likely, I would say, that question mark is likely to endure. Israel as a state, not just as an occupying power, as a state, its legitimacy has suffered an irreparable blow, in my opinion. That scarlet letter G for genocide has now been affixed to it. I would have to say, you said, in my opinion, the crucial difference between South Africa and Israel is South Africa never attempted a sustained public intellectual justification for South Africa for a simple reason. It was a completely lost cause because it was the middle of the civil rights movement in the United States. Mm. A Jim Crow system in South Africa, where our whole society was in the process of repudiating it in the American South. It was a Sisyphean labor to try to make a public intellectual defense for South African apartheid in the United States in the 1960s and 70s. Israel obviously has invested a huge amount of resources, public and private, behind the scenes, behind closed doors, and publicly, to trying to defend its legitimacy and also trying to repress in brutal mafia-like ways any dissent from the so-called, I hate the word, but I'll use it now, the Israeli narrative of speaking to its legitimacy. But there is another difference where many people, I don't call myself pro-Palestinian, I call myself pro-truth and pro-justice. many people on the so-called pro-Palestinian side, I don't believe they're giving a hard look at the situation. What do I mean by that? In South Africa, as I said earlier, the African National Congress was ideologically committed to one person, one vote. They were not committed to an ethnically black state. Now, you might say that's just a play on words, since black people were the majority, overwhelming majority in South Africa. Mm-hmm. One person, one vote is going to mean a black state. For sheer demographic reasons. That is, and it isn't true. I would say there was a deep-seated ideological commitment by the South Africans beyond simply becoming a black state through the back door of being the demographic majority. So I'll give you an example. Well, first of all, there were many whites in the African National Congress. Okay. They were welcomed, they were active, and they played a very critical role. But secondly, as an ideological matter, the second ranking person in the ANC was a fellow named Walter Sisulu. And Walter Sisulu was once asked, do you expect to live to see a black president of South Africa? And his reply was, I'm not interested in the black president of South Africa. I'm interested in a democratically elected president of South Africa. One person, one vote. And I do believe that was a sincere commitment. I can't prove it. Maybe it was Machiavellian, that he knew if we got the vote, we're going to have our black president. I don't believe it was Machiavellian, because I understand the mentality of that tradition. I feel part of that tradition. It's the tradition of the socialist communist era, this commitment to an all-embracing humanity, mm-hmm. now embodied in the South African rainbow flag, namely, we are a multicultural society, we represent everybody. I think I was sincere. I'm not faulting, I'm not nitpicking. There has never been that kind of commitment among the Palestinian solidarity, Palestinian movement inside Palestine. It was always an Arab nationalist movement. Yeah, there were some elements, people are going to say Dr. George Habash in the PFLP, but I would say pretty marginal. Overwhelmingly, it was a Arab nationalist movement. And Islamic movements, the Hamas and other Islamic movements, they are what you might call a extreme version of this Arab-Muslim nationalism. It's not Arab nationalism, it's Muslim, but it's also Arab nationalism. I can see a coexistence with Israel. I mean, the talk of one state just doesn't make any sense to me, because you can't have one state if at least on one side you don't have a deep commitment to a democratic state. You take the case of our own American South. One of the reasons, our own in the United States, one of the reasons the civil rights movement could happen is because, for various reasons, blacks in the American South, they were not vindictive. They really weren't. They were genuinely committed to peaceful coexistence on political equality. Give us the vote, and then we can live together. You know, obviously, it also meant improving the life, the material life. But at a political level, it was give us the vote, one person, one vote, and desegregate the facilities because the facilities were unequal. I don't believe there's such an ideological commitment on either side. The Jews are absolutely committed to a Jewish supremacist state. And I don't believe there's a, I don't want to call it a democratic culture. I would call it a democratic mindset. Namely, the mindset is this land belongs to us. And I don't see as a practical matter, if you talk about one state now, okay, can you imagine a coalition government or a federated government between Mr. Sinwar and Mr. Netanyahu, or Mr. Sinwar and
I thought that would be an extreme scenario.
Well, but when you think it through, isn't that what it comes down to?
Thank you, Norman. That's Norman Finkelstein. Amazing ideas he's coming out with there, really, about the end of Israel's credibility. And so isn't it interesting, Netanyahu talking about Hamas trying to destroy Israel? Well, maybe Netanyahu is the one who's destroying Israel, not Hamas at all. You notice that there's been a lot of destruction, basically falling away and falling apart of the Israeli government just around Netanyahu, and get Benny Gantz stepped aside waiting for it all to collapse so he can step in and take over. I don't know if he'll be any better, probably not, but Israeli government in free fall. Maybe Netanyahu will go to jail, who knows. Going back to October, November last year, Tory MP Crispin Blunt warned that the Sunak government will be guilty of war crimes, or maybe if they support verbally or materially the Israelis in what was going on in Gaza. The next day, he was arrested and accused of rape and drug dealing. So isn't that, I mean, it's a perfect example, as I said at the start, of the hatchet jobs on the heroes. This is the guy who's, he's actually a pro-Palestinian, he's a conservative MP, but he's just going completely booted out for doing the right thing very early on in all this. So let's have a listen to that now, both the speech by Crispin Blunt on one of the news programmes about the problems with the legality of this war for British politicians, and then the announcement on another channel about him being arrested.
A group supporting Palestinian rights has written to the Prime Minister outlining its intention to prosecute UK government officials for their approach to the Israel-Hamas conflict. The International Centre of Justice for Palestinians says that the UK government is aiding and abetting war crimes in Gaza. Well, we can speak now to their co-director, Crispin Blunt, an MP and former chair of the Commons Foreign Affairs Committee. Very good morning to you, Mr. Blunt. This is an unusual position, isn't it, for you to be in, to be writing to the Prime Minister and saying you could be complicit in war crimes?
Well, it's the Prime Minister of whom I'm an enthusiastic supporter. And I'm not entirely sure that my colleagues have quite grasped the legal peril that they are in, or fully understand the international law in this area. You can't encourage powers to commit war crimes, or indeed, if the United Kingdom is not, as other members of the international community ought to be, pointing out to the Israelis that their actions are breaches of international law, breaches of the fundamental settlement that followed the Second World War, in detail, and what we're seeing on the television, but the forcible transfer of all those people is a direct breach of war crimes. Everyone must act to restrain people if you know it's going to happen. If you know that a party is going to commit a war crime, and this forcible transfer of people is a precise breach of one of the statutes that governs international law and all states in this area, then you are making yourself complicit. And as international law has developed in this area, the fact of being complicit makes you equally guilty to the party carrying out the crime. And this is really how, this is now the last defence for Palestinians in this situation, is that international law will then begin to operate, make international leaders conscious of their duties under international law, and the fact that they, in the end, they can't ignore it. And they ought to be acting to restrain our ally from taking actions that are breaches of international
law. So that is what you're warning the Prime Minister, that you're saying that that is what he and other government ministers must do.
It goes beyond government ministers. Indeed, any politician who is then egging Israel on to breach international law and support Israel in the conduct of this operation.
So what you are calling on is for a change in language, or if you, are you calling on the government not to be sending those auxiliary ships?
I think that we would suggest to the government is they ought to be supporting the UN Secretary General's call for an immediate ceasefire and for getting aid and supplies into the beleaguered population in Gaza. And that needs to be the first action. In Israel's case, Israel has had a deal of exceptionalism and impunity from international law for a very long time now. In the interest of us all, and indeed Israel itself, that needs to stop.
Hello, my name is Monica and this is The Know. Crispin Blunt has confirmed he is the Tory MP arrested over an allegation of rape and possession of drugs. The former Conservative politician has had the Tory whip suspended pending the outcome of a police investigation into the allegations. Crispin Blunt has been an MP for Reigate since 1997. Confirming the reports, he explained an arrest on Wednesday was the second time he's been quizzed about the incident, saying the arrest was unnecessary and he is confident the investigation will end without charge. In a statement, Mr. Blunt said, "It has been reported that an MP was arrested yesterday in connection with an allegation of rape. I am confirming that MP was me. The fact of the arrest requires a formal notification of the Speaker and then my Chief Whip. I remain ready to cooperate fully with the investigation that I am confident will end without charge. I do not intend to say anything further on this matter until the police has completed their inquiries."
Absolutely bonkers. Look at that. Amazing. Tory MP Crispin Blunt says, "Watch out, you might be arrested for war crimes if you support the Israelis." And then the next day, he's arrested for something almost certainly spurious. So let's go on to Ukraine now. Aleksandar Vučić, he's the president of Serbia. He said this week. He believes there's a real problem of a war coming down the road. And he's sent out this warning to the world this week.
"The train has left the station and no one can stop it. And it looks like that. And I believe that we are getting close to the last days of possible rethinking and reconsidering of everything that is happening in Ukraine. If those big powers don't do anything in a short period of time, yes, I'm pretty much certain that we'll face a real disaster. If you bet on a fact that someone is bluffing, it means that you have no better cards. But you just believe that the other side has weaker cards. And you're not sure about it because you don't know and you didn't see his or their cards. Everybody is speaking only about war. Nobody wants to reach the peace. Nobody speaks about peace. Peace is almost a forbidden word. And please notice this. As they say, we need to win in order to secure future peace. But nobody's speaking about a peace. And then, okay, you negotiate it. But you have the other side. You have to have the other side on the table as well. It's, it's very strange to me that no one is actually attempting to stop the war. There is another theory, which I can understand, which I don't say that I do approve, but I understand that West thinks that they can win easily against Putin. They want to exhaust him in Ukraine, and then they will enter the space, and then Russia in today's territory and shaped like it is today won't exist anymore, and Putin will be overthrown and everything else. Yeah, maybe that's possible, but...
Do you think that is possible? Is it possible to use Ukraine to weaken Russia?
Well, it weakened Russia anyway. Mm-hmm. But is it enough to destroy Russia and to overthrow Putin? I don't believe so. In today's Europe, they all act like big heroes. But they did not say to their people that they will pay a very big price. And speaking about it, you and all these leaders should do absolutely everything in order to stop any kind of warmongering behavior and everything. Why I'm speaking that we are getting close to the precipice, to the abyss. Analyze the situation of NATO and the United States. They cannot afford themselves losing war in Ukraine, which means Russia cannot win. Because, first of all, their political legacy will not exist, or it will be so poor that they cannot allow themselves. Number two, position of Europe and the West, collective West, in geopolitical terms, will deteriorate so much that no one would be able to revive it and to renew it. And number three, it will open Pandora's box for more movements, at least, and hostilities against collective West in the future. But take the other side. That's a nice story for one side. Take the other side. If Putin loses the war, Russia will not exist and won't be shaped like it is today. And then when you have these two sides so much far from each other, with their wishes, with their expectations, then you see that everything is at stake. Everything. No one can afford to himself or to itself, to themselves, to lose. When you have this situation, that's why I was saying to you, that's why I was saying publicly and not hiding it, that we are getting closer to a real disaster. Who is ready to lose 1 million, 2 million, 5 million, 10 and 15 million people? Ask yourself. I'm not ready to lose a single man, and we won't participate in that. But it's a question for some other people.
How close are we now to a third world war, a confrontation?
I cannot say a third world war, but a big confrontation, how far we are, I believe that we are not far away from it. Not more than 3-4 months. And there is a danger to happen even before that.
Where do you stand in this whole insanity? Where does Serbia stand in this conflict?
We'll keep peace, stability and tranquility within the region and in our country.
Serbian President Aleksandar Vučić this week warning the world that war is coming to Europe. And that, of course, chimes in exactly with what Andrew Bridgen was saying the other week, that the war has already started, that just that the British public have not been told. And also, of course, what George Galloway was saying this week, too, about war within 6 months, open war, if Starmer is elected, which almost certainly he will be, as I'm sure Galloway knows. Being quite clever, Galloway, really, isn't he? He's not saying I support Putin in any way. He's just warning us of where our side is heading with all this. So then let's have a listen to Jeffrey Sachs. We hear from him quite a bit on here. Jeffrey Sachs talking about the G7 here and attempts to make peace in Ukraine. He's was a very, very well-respected government consultant over in the United States and economist, etc. But he's been very outspoken both about COVID and about the war in Ukraine.
The G7 countries, but mainly the United States, which is the leader of the G7, grew into a lot of arrogance over the years, believing they could do what they want, say what they want, win where they would want to win, and so on. This has gotten the world into three massive geopolitical crises right now. Of course, Ukraine, complete disaster for Ukraine itself, first and foremost, but also for Europe and the rest of the world. The devastating war, a genocidal war by Israel in Gaza, and tensions that are at the edge of exploding into open war in East Asia and especially over Taiwan. The U.S. is, to my mind, an irresponsible actor in all three of these events. When it comes to Ukraine, the irresponsibility is that this war could easily have been avoided, and I really mean easily, by NATO, that means the U.S., declaring clearly NATO will not expand to Ukraine. This was a promise given to the Soviet and Russian leaders back in the early 1990s that NATO wouldn't move one inch eastward, and then NATO has moved or tried to move relentlessly eastward.
U.S. government consultant Jeffrey Sachs there talking about the G7's attitude to peace in Ukraine. Doesn't seem that there is one, really, does it? They don't really seem to care at all. Also worth mentioning this week, interesting reports around the world. This one is just from the Metro. I'll put a version of this up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Putin is a saviour sent by God to stop World War III, says a fan of nuclear war. This is, I think, referring to the piece we did last week. This is the image projected by Professor Sergei Karaganov, former advisor to Putin, who spoke at the Kremlin-organized Russian Davos last week. He's hawkish even next to Putin, having urged the president to launch tactical nuclear strikes against the West to warn them off supporting Ukraine. He suggested holding a nuclear pistol to the head of the West. But it was his description of Putin that was most revealing of the 71-year-old Russian president's worldview. Well, I don't know if they're really talking about the president. This is a separate guy. This is Karaganov. He said, "I clearly remember 1998 to 99, when our country was on the edge, falling apart. The situation was dire. I remember me and my comrades fighting without any hope left. And at some point, God Almighty took pity on us." And in big commas, and Putin arrived. "Now, Vladimir Vladimirovich, you have a difficult task, not only to win, but also to save the world, which is sliding and being pushed into a world war." An accompanying propaganda video showed images of British soldiers fighting under the Union Jack, trunks overflowing with treasure, and slaves in chains. It blamed the colonial march of the West for the world's ills and framed Russia as the only country in history able to resist it. He did talk, didn't he, about this is the third time that they've come for us. I don't know if you remember that clip in the clip we played last week, that little section. I thought it was quite an interesting one. So what about Stoltenberg, NATO boss? What's he got to say? "NATO and Ukraine cannot cede territory." Quite correct, of course. They mustn't, must they? Stoltenberg is just going, saying goodbye to him. Mark Rutte comes in, who's a former boss of, from the Netherlands, isn't he? But what's, has he got anything useful to add? Let's see, Stoltenberg.
"It's not for Ukraine to withdraw forces from Ukrainian territory. It's for Russia to withdraw their forces from occupied Ukrainian land. And this proposal is a proposal that actually means that Russia should have the right to occupy even more Ukrainian land. All the four provinces that they claim are not Ukrainian. So this just demonstrates that this is not a proposal made in good faith, but this is a proposal that actually means that Russia should achieve their war games aims by also expecting or expecting that Ukraine should give up significantly more land than Russia has been able to occupy so far. So this is not a peace proposal. This is a proposal of more aggression, more occupation, and it demonstrates in a way that that Russia's aim is to control Ukraine, and that has been the purpose of Russia since the beginning of this war, and that's a blatant violation of international law, and that's also the reason why NATO allies continue to support Ukraine.
That was Jens Stoltenberg, outgoing Secretary General of NATO. Well, he's saying Ukraine cannot cede territory. Well, it has to, and it will, and it absolutely... He's just not living in the real world. He wants his perpetual war. He wants his endless war. Thanks very much, Stoltenberg. Goodbye to you, Bilderberger, of course. But anyway, what about the possibilities of civil defence? Well, this was dealt with here in the UK by Roger Cook on the Cook Report, this programme that we had a look at. It disappeared for 30 years and it's reappeared on the Roger Cook YouTube channel. The film's called Dirty Bomb. Here is what they've got to say about British civil defence in the 1990s. This was 93, this was recorded.
Eric Alley designed nuclear bunkers like this. This was to have been a command post in the event of nuclear war. Now it's being decommissioned by the government. An EEC survey shows Britain has the weakest civil defence emergency system in the whole of Europe.
Good afternoon, sir.
We wanted to test reaction in America to a terrorist nuclear bomb and went through Heathrow with the blessing of the authorities. Watching the men with the machine guns. Airports are another favourite target for terrorists. Replica or not, the airline still insisted on full security precautions.
What exactly is this?
In New York, our story was news.
A British TV reporter says he was offered 55 pounds of weapons-grade plutonium by a dealer in Moscow, who gave him a sample that proved to be the real thing. That's enough for four nuclear bombs. The scary deal, caught on video, did not go through.
However, neither the police, nor the FBI, nor the New York City authorities would even contemplate discussing the threat of terrorists with nuclear bombs. As far as they're publicly concerned, it's unthinkable. But we did meet Bob Cooperman, whose job it is to think the unthinkable.
Well, that's a scale model of the type of weapon we are told we could have built with the materials we were offered in Russia.
My God, it's a gun-type weapon.
No one knows more than Dr. Cooperman about nuclear weaponry and terrorism.
The fissile material. You know, I think my worst fears, certainly from the days that I was in the White House and the days that I was chief scientist of the U.S. arms control efforts, and now that I'm involved with counterterrorism for the past decade or more, my worst fears are coming true.
An extract from the Cook Report there from 1993. This is something called the Civil Contingencies Act, which replaced the Civil Defence Act. Now, the Civil Defence protected people. Civil Contingencies Act doesn't. So the idea is that it will protect, people from political parties, great, and the rich, but it won't protect the people. The Civil Contingencies Act is horrific. Anyway, it's talked about a bit there in the Cook Report. That is Dirty Bomb, which you can find online. I'll put a link to it up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. And finally, on Ukraine, what about the Americans here in Britain? What are they up to? Here's a clip from many years ago. I think this is around about 2008, 2005, something like that, about the trial of Ian Huntley and Maxine Carr, the Holly and Jessica Chapman murders, very close to one of the big American bases at Lake and Heath over in East Anglia. So here's Dave Starbuck explaining that actually there was a court-martial that went on inside the US base at the time.
Dave Starbuck, and welcome to another presentation from Revelation Tapes. In September 2002, I heard a tape lecture entitled who really murdered Holly Wells and Jessica Chapman. For the benefit of those who did not hear this presentation, although the case was the fugacy of the time, among many other things, I put forward a hypothesis that has not been explored. Probably for political reasons, or if it had, the general public had not been made aware of it, because the mainstream media totally ignored the relevant points that were put forward. The three principal ones being: A, the real culprit or culprits for this heinous crime could have been an American serviceman or men stationed at one of the nearby bases in the vicinity where the bodies were found. B, that Ian Huntley and Maxine Carr were patsies or scapegoats who were fit up by the powers that be. This was because of Tony Blair's war on terror and the political ramifications and possible public outcry if the contents of point A turn out to be correct. C, an expose of the use of toxic psychiatry, the side effects of certain neuroleptic drugs, and how people can be whisked into mental institutions such as Rampton without their consent, whether they are mentally ill or not, and used as guinea pigs. Since the release of the aforementioned tape, which incidentally was a considerable success, I've received countless letters and phone calls from people who were in total or partial agreement with the contents and offering additional information. Indeed, one of my listeners was so outraged that he made several copies and sent them to people he considered responsible public figures who could use their influence. As far as I know, we received no response. Another one of my listeners, a barrister no less, even wrote to the Lord Chief Justice, protesting about the treatment of Maxine Carr. He did receive a reply, but having said that, it was similar to those received when one writes to most MPs, raising some sensitive issue that might rock the political vote and put them in danger of losing their jobs if they dare speak out. I have received many such letters which I call four-line follow-up, or worse to that effect. Before the trial of the accused, I sent copies of this tape to several people, including the editor of the Cambridge Evening News, the solicitors who were representing Maxine Carr, along with the additional information obtained on very good authority that whoever was responsible for this crime cut off the fingers and toes of the victim before burning the bodies. This was not reported in any newspapers or brought up at the trial, as far as I'm aware. Needless to say, like many of my listeners, I received no replies to my correspondence. Another disturbing incident that was not reported in the press was that hard proof that the monster or monsters who murdered Holly and Jessica might well reside inside the razor wire at USAF Laken Heath was provided at a court-martial held on the 23rd of July, 2003. A military judge found against Technical Sergeant Randy Bitter on three charges of child sex abuse. Technical Sergeant Bitter pleaded guilty to carnal knowledge with a female child under 12 years of age and two counts of indecent acts for the same victim. He was sentenced to 6 years imprisonment with dishonorable discharge from the United States Air Force. Despite the fact that Bitter was convicted less than 500 yards away from the exact point at which Holly Wells and Jessica Chapman's bodies were dumped, not one British newspaper or television network anywhere in the land reported these horrifying crimes, details of which were made available in immediate press release 073103-4, dated the 31st of July, 2003, at the United States Air Force Base, Laken Heath. Predictably, perhaps, these frightening look-alike offences and their obvious implication have been withheld from the jurors in the trial of Ian Huntley and Maxine Carr.
Well, how interesting. It's possible these kids were killed by US servicemen and that Ian Huntley and Maxine Carr were just set up because they happened to be nearby somewhere. So Dave Starbuck there, an oldie but goodie from him. I'm not saying that's true, but isn't it interesting? Why haven't we heard this kind of thing about the US presence here? And it would explain, you know, this whole idea of the United States being kind of megally in charge of Britain and why we're so beholden to them. So winding up now, let's have a listen to Jack Hargreaves. This is Stonehenge, the solstice. I always get a little bit perturbed when I see people like Silky Carlo from Big Brother Watch going down to Stonehenge, you know, for the summer solstice or some big party. Yeah, but what was Stonehenge really all about, folks? Anyone that's actually seen the Quatermass Conclusion, which is one of those Quatermass films, it's brilliant. Well worth watching. I think it's in four parts or something. It was shown on the TV in the late 1970s, around about 1980. Brilliant film, and it shows you all these hippies being lured to these old Stone Age sites and then being basically they're being sucked up by aliens and these massive weird beams. But anyway, I don't want to spoil it too much. It's brilliant. All these like hippies going around with machine guns and machine pistols and this sort of thing, rounding all the other hippies up. And anyway, it's a very interesting film. We never see that on the TV anymore, do we? But anyway, Stonehenge, everyone's there having a great big party, but wasn't this actually really a site for human sacrifice?
Now, there's been an awful lot of academic argument about what the original purposes of Stonehenge was, or even whether it was all built at the same time, or parts of it were built by different peoples. A lot of people have tried to build their academic reputation, or destroy the academic reputation of somebody else by writing about Stonehenge and arguing about it. But one thing is absolutely certain, and that is, it is a calendar. And it's a calendar which belonged and was built by the priesthood of a people whose religion was based on the sun. They knew, whatever else they didn't know about the nature of the universe, they knew that their lives depended on the sun. It was the fact that the sun rose higher and higher every year to bring summer and bring crops that made it possible for them to go on living. And they feared, as the sun started to go away again in the summer and gradually disappear further and further away, that it wouldn't come back. And the priesthood was not going to argue with them about that, because I have absolutely no doubt that the priesthood never let the public in on it, so to speak, as to what they knew about the nature of the astrological bodies. They knew that that is what happened every midwinter's day. You see that? That is the sun rising at midwinter's day, exactly between those stones, just about looking at it with a rifle sight. And where I'm standing now is where it rises on Midsummer's Day. And week by week, in the meanwhile, if you were to spend your whole time here, and you were to get up every morning before dawn, as you did at in order to mark the bedroom window ledge, you would find the sun moving along like this. And the people prayed and hoped that the sun this year wouldn't disappear altogether. And the priests promised them that they would use their power to bring it back. And they probably threw in a couple of human sacrifices to make the whole thing look believable. And then the day came when the sun rose there. And the next day it rose a little to the left. And the priests said, "Gods have answered our wishes, our prayers. The sun is coming back to give you another year of life." And that way they maintained their power. And here you see, now there, we said there, in line with her, that is where the sun rises on midwinter day, and over there's where it rises on midsummer day.
Jack Hargreaves there from the Out of Town series on Stonehenge. He does a brilliant piece actually just before that, which is about brick making, which is unbelievable. The way old ways people used to make brick. There were still a few around in the 1980s. I think that was recorded actually, 1986. So priesthood's power and calendars and human sacrifice. So I think people should just understand that actually prehistory did include these kind of Canaanite faiths and Phoenician type ideas of human sacrifice. A lot of evidence for that, which people like English Heritage are very reluctant to talk about. Finally though, Tim Dews, let's relax into the election, sort of get away from the whole election nonsense, by hearing from Tim. He flies a small German aircraft and he does these great pyrotechnic displays. I came across him after driving near Warminster one day and seeing this kind of weird thing. It looked like aliens at twilight up in the sky, but actually it's him and his aircraft.
It's a flat four VW based engine. It's based on a 2 litre engine and it's been tweaked by Grob up to 2.5 litres. Develops 95 horsepower. It only revs to 3,300.
I mean, that's not much more powerful than your average car, is it, really?
Well, normally in a car, for every litre, you'd get 100 horsepower. So out of 2.5 litre, you'd be looking at 250 horsepower in a car, revving to about 6,000 or 8,000. But in an aircraft, the propeller obviously can't go that fast, otherwise it goes supersonic, and they get the reliability out of it by only revving it to 3,300.
So what sort of power are you getting out compared to a car?
Well, out of this 2.5 litre engine, we're only getting 95 horsepower.
I'm surprised that an aircraft has to be much less powerful than a car. Why is that?
The long wings on them make them very efficient. It doesn't need much more than that to fly. The other aeroplanes, the Cessnas and the like, have 5 and 6 litre engines and more horsepower, but they use more fuel. This at 90 miles an hour, it sips fuel at about 15 litres an hour.
Okay, so a Piper and a Cessna, most of the planes we've seen going over, the light aircraft, are these American aircraft. So how does this... I mean, to the sound, this compares quite favourably with those.
Well, they're generally about 150 to 180 horsepower with up to 5 litre engines. This is very economic and quiet, which is why it makes it perfect for what we use it for, the displays.
How much can you actually fit in there, in the cockpit?
It'll take 2 100-kilo pilots and 20 kilos of baggage with 100 litres of fuel. So its duration is 6 hours, and most people's bladders is about 3.
How far can you fly this thing, then? What's the range?
I've done 2 6-hour flights to Finland. We did Portugal last weekend in 8.5 hours, coming back with 1 stop at La Rochelle for fuel. So you can fly it for 6 hours at just under 100 miles an hour.
Okay, so I suppose the bottom line, for anyone curious, is how much is one of these going to set you back?
These were all built in the late 80s, and they came on the market at about 38,000. They tend to change hands now in the region of 40,000 to 55,000. If they built this same aeroplane today, exactly as it is, with the cost of materials and bits and pieces, it would be about £150,000 to £160,000.
So why such a difference?
It's 30 years old.
Are they building anything like this anymore?
No, they're not at all. But
so it's almost like it's becoming a bit of a classic aeroplane.
It is, but the RAF fleet have just been purchased by a charity called Aerability, and they're going to re-engine them with a more modern Rotex engine and put a hook on them so they can use them as glider tugs and work them back into the light aviation market. So they're not dead. They're life at 12,000 hours. And most of these aeroplanes in here, I think this one's got 1,500 on it, and this one's got about 4,000 hours on it in 30 years. So it won't be my lifetime it'll be a problem.
What about the uses of them? What are they mostly used for, other than what you're doing?
Well, they're like a lot of aeroplanes, they're toys, aren't they? Unfortunately, our weather is for glider pilots isn't the best all the time. So when the weather's not good for gliding, you can use these. And they're full night capable, but they do fly in visual flight conditions. So the weather has to be... They can't fly instrument rated. They have to fly in reasonable weather, whether it be night or day.
So it's basically a motor glider. Why is that more or less useful than having, say, a normal light aircraft? Why would someone buy one of these rather than have a Cessna or a Piper?
They're more graceful, they're quieter. You can actually shut the engine off and go gliding in them. They say it's 28 to 1 is the glide ratio, so for every foot down, it'll go 28 forward. Your average Cessna is about 7, so not very streamlined. Plus, you're looking at the economy of 15 litres an hour with one of these, and probably 35 to 40 litres an hour with a Cessna or a Piper.
So how did you get into doing displays?
It was, again, through Aerability and the 2012 Paralympic opening ceremony.
Okay, so tell us a bit about this Aerability. What is that?
Well, it's a glider pilot from Lasham, who's now very disabled, and he set the charity up to teach disabled people to fly, and they're based at Blackbush, and they have 3 or 4 aeroplanes, and they get people flying. So they're at Blackbush, it's near Farnborough, up the M3, and I've seen the people that they've got flying, and it's I think it's a brilliant course.
What's the idea of getting disabled people up in the air?
to keep them going, to give them something to strive for. And there's no reason being disabled that you can't fly. There's a girl in America flying with no arms at all. She flies a whole aeroplane with her legs.
What? How do you do that? You can't. You stick. I mean, goodness me, how does she do it?
She has a video of her online doing it. She does it all with her feet, the throttle, the radio, everything with her feet. It's absolutely amazing to watch.
Okay, doing the displays then, when did you first realise, actually, this is something that I could maybe do a little bit more of?
Well, as I say, we were involved with the Paralympic opening ceremony where they had a disabled person flying over London with pyros on the aeroplane. And we had a party here on the Strip the same year, 2012, and I put some pyros on the grob and flew it, and somebody made a video.
So what are these, just like fireworks, November the 5th fireworks, you stick on the side of the plane?
Some are, the Roman candles are, but the waterfalls we use are handmade for us, and they burn at about 15,000 degrees C, so we have to have quite complicated stainless steel mounts to stop them burning the aeroplane.
Oh, I bet.
And we have to be careful that we don't set anything on fire, so we have a safety height above 1,500 feet, at which we don't deploy the fireworks.
Okay. The wing of this aircraft, is it some sort of metal? Is it? I mean, obviously, if you've got pyrotechnics, you don't really want a plastic or some kind of fiberglass wing, do you?
It is a fiberglass wing.
Oh, no.
But there's no fuel in it. The fuel is in the fuselage. The wings are dry. And we have a stainless steel fitting that goes on the tip of the wingtip that takes all the fireworks, and they can burn to their heart's content without hurting the aeroplane.
I imagine you're just doing evening displays then, if you're doing fireworks.
No, we do three displays. We do a day show with coloured smoke on the wingtips and engine smoke, and then we do a twilight display with the engine smoke and the LEDs on the fuselage, and then we do a full night show with the LEDs and the pyrotechnics on the wingtips.
Okay, so where have you been recently? Have you been doing any of this during the pandemic, the lockdown?
It did screw it up for everybody, but we did New Year's Eve in Portugal, and we've just finished 8 displays in Portugal last week, and we've done, I think, 3 weddings and parties just before we went out to Portugal, and we were meant to be at Leszno in Poland this weekend coming, but we thought we'd be quarantined, and we had to cancel it. But a lot of the shows were cancelled.
So what were you doing in Portugal? Tell us about that display.
It was laid on by Albufeira Town Council to say thank you to the Portuguese people who basically kept the industry alive by going to the beaches. They're down 90% on their tourism. So it was a thank you to do for them. And it was, they didn't know anything about it. We just rocked up on the beach. They played the vans rocked up and played the music. And
turned up out of the skies to the surprise of the people on the beach in the evening.
In the afternoon, yeah.
Oh, it was an afternoon. It wasn't an evening thing.
No fireworks. It was all days. It was just to get the people on the beach, just to say thank you to them.
And I suppose they've mostly left the beach by the time the sun goes down anyway.
That's right. They're in the hotels or the bars by then. But
okay, so what sort of display was it? So if I was sitting on the beach or standing on the beach, what would I have seen?
Well, the first thing you'd have heard is the music. They had these big trucks with big speakers and beautiful reproduction sound of Polish bands. And it had 1:45 intro, and then you would have seen this heart being drawn in the sky by these two aeroplanes that were basically inaudible. And then after that, we went into a 10-minute display of loops and wingovers and quarter clovers set to the music.
So you're talking about vehicles that actually drive out onto the beach, which are purpose-built, almost like maybe with a flatbed on the back of the van, a pickup with giant speakers on. That sounds like an interesting idea.
Well, that's exactly what it was, and the people absolutely loved it. It went down very well. But we were out there at New Year's Eve, the Carpenox. They had 140,000 people on the beach, and they put a big stage up. And we did the same thing for New Year's Eve after the countdown to New Year's Eve. We were out there flying, but that was a full night show with pyros.
So you're practicing. Now, I think that's where I first came across you, driving out of Warminster one evening, spotted you.
Well, my son and I, we run the team as Airborne Pyrotechnics, and we keep in practice every nice evening. We only live half a mile away, so it's no big hardship to just finish dinner and come and have an hour or so doing the routines just to keep the hand in.
So, I mean, a lot of this, what you're talking about here, these are aerobatic manoeuvres. I mean, you're going upside down, round and round. I mean, surely that's going to affect your concentration and maybe a bit dangerous, actually.
Everything has an element of risk. The daylight shows are not a problem. The evening ones, twilight, are not a problem either. the dark shows, the full night shows in the middle of nowhere where there's no lights or ground reference points, can cause problems. And when that's the case, we tend to, or even over the sea, if you're displaying over the sea, there's just nothing, it's black. And when the fireworks go off, your eyes, pupils just shrink right down and your night vision just goes out the window. So we tend to keep the manoeuvres very simple in those conditions.
So where did you learn to do your aerobatics, or did you just learn it yourself?
Oh, at various gliding clubs over the years, and I've been looking after these aeroplanes for 35 years since they came on the market, and they're beautiful for it. They're perfect. The nice thing about the motor glider, if glider aerobatics are silent, so they start very high and they're nearly over by the time people realise it's going on. Whereas the motor glider, you can hold that box from 1,500 feet down to 800 feet, and you can do the whole display for about 8 minutes in that box, and that's most people's attention span.
Well, that's actually not too noisy. We can hear ourselves think.
Yeah, well, let's say it's only 95 horsepower with a nice big silencer, and that's one of the advantages of the aeroplanes. We practice a lot around here, and nobody complains about the noise because it is so quiet. They're going to run round the corner and accelerate to the west there. And if we're not airborne in 350 metres, then we're going to stop and come back and take some fuel out.
Traffic, 10 o'clock,
above 6 feet. Have a go to gliding club. There's one at the Kingston Devil, the park, and there's Keevil, banner down at Keevil Airfield. That's by far the best way to get into the air without spending huge amounts of money. And if you've got more money to spend, then there's Compton-Abbas where you can go and fly an aeroplane. But the minute you put an engine on the front, the cost trebles.
I love your little airfield here, because most people would drive past, they wouldn't even know you were here. I wonder how many of these small strips there are around the country.
Lots. There are lots. And you only see them because there's an aeroplane parked outside. There are lots, especially if you're flying. You see that there's a new one just gone up in Westbury. It's just this side of Westbury, and you can fly. You can put a strip on your own land and operate it 28 days a year without any planning permission.
Amazing. Well, okay, so if people want to find you online, whereabouts? What's the best place to look and find your videos?
They can Google Tim Dews or Google Airborne Pyrotechnics or YouTube. You'll get me very quickly on any of those.
Okay, Tim, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
That's Tim Dews there, Airborne Pyrotechnics, he calls himself, and Airborne Composites. He does a lot of repairs for fiberglass aircraft of various sorts, light aircraft and gliders and things like that down at Wing Farm, which is one of those beautiful little, you sort of walk across a footpath into a field and you find, crikey, this is a field. It's not just a field, it's an airfield. And there's a hangar at the end of it, and that's Tim. So that's all for this week. Time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, particularly Heiko Koo, and also to Dia Moodley. You can download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like. Follow Tony Gosling Censored on Telegram. Do please send me interviews and story tips via Not the BCFM Politics show page. We'll also find the podcast, the full-length interviews, story links, comment page, and our email addresses. You can subscribe to my free weekly newsletter. If you can afford it, you can even donate or set up a small monthly sub at thisweekoneword.org.uk. We've been streaming from the People's Republic of Stokescroft in Bristol on the talkradio.org.uk stream, at radioquk.com in Camberley, Surrey, at DJ Plug Radio in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, and radiosoapbox.com in Worthing, East Sussex. Also live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app. If you can restream us live or rebroadcast us, just let me know and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend away from the election and away from the empire of lies. You get everything you need to know on here. You don't need to listen to all that nonsense. And do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show next Friday at 5 live at God Bless. And don't let the satanic banksters get you down.
Baby.